Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, it's Friday, January the 24th, 2014. I almost said 13. 2014. And what do we have that's going on? Right now, I hear some bells ring. And why is those bells ringing? Because it must be my cell phone. But anyway, we have a big lineup today. A big, big lineup today. A whole lot of things are going on. A whole lot of things. Let's see if one of these strikes a bell about telling the truth.
You snotty little bastard.
Your Honor, I'd like to ask for a recess.
I'd like an answer to the question, Judge.
The court will wait for an answer.
If Lieutenant Kendrick gave an order that Santiago wasn't to be touched, why did he have to be transferred? Colonel, Lieutenant Kendrick ordered the code red, didn't he? Because that's what you told Lieutenant Kendrick to do.
Object!
And when it went bad, you cut these guys loose.
Your Honor,
you had Marcus inside a phony transport.
Your Honor,
you doctored the logbook.
Damn it, Captain!
You coerced the doctor.
Consider yourself in contempt.
Colonel Jackson, did you order the code red?
You don't have to answer that question.
I'll answer the question. You want answers?
I think I'm entitled to.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth! Son, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's going to do it? You? You, Lieutenant Weinberg? I have a greater responsibility than you can possibly fathom. You weep for Santiago, and you curse the Marines. You have that luxury. You have the luxury of not knowing what I know. Santiago's death, while tragic, probably saved lives. And my existence, while grotesque and incomprehensible to you, saves lives. You don't want the truth because deep down in places you don't talk about at parties, you want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. We use words like honor, code, loyalty. We use these words as the backbone of a life spent defending something. You use them as a punchline. I have neither the time nor the inclination to explain myself to a man who rises and sleeps under the blanket of the very freedom that I provide and then questions the manner in which I provide it. I would rather you just said thank you and went on your way. Otherwise, I suggest you pick up a weapon and stand a post. Either way, I don't give a damn what you think you are entitled to.
Did you order the code red?
I did the job.
Did you order the code red?
You're goddamn right I did!
There it is. Did Chris Christie order the code red on the George Washington Bridge? Did he order Bridget, his second in command, to do the deed for the Brooklyn Bridge? And then did she then tell Wildstein, the crony over at the Port Authority, at the Port Authority, to tell Baroni to do the deal? How did this work? Or did they just say for a wink and a nod? You know what the man wants. You know what the man wants. Go ahead and do it. Did they order the code red on the George Washington Bridge? Now, for those who have been in some far out country and don't know what the heck has been going on since last September, because you see, this has not been a story that just came up last week. This is not a story that, oh boy, these things just happened so fast. This thing has been going on really a few months. In September, it would be another year. This first came about in September of this year, of the past year, when the same week, remind you, the same week as 9/11, the same week as the first day of school for the kids in Jersey. The same day as the 9/11 happened, the anniversary of 9/11, that is, the same week of a Jewish holiday, when Bridget and Kelly, according to Governor Christie, told David Wildstein, who worked at the Port Authority, it's time to have traffic problems in Fort Lee. Now, let's say Fort Lee, David Wildstein, it just was a text to David Wildstein. David Wildstein sent back, got it. Now, so no matter if anybody else ain't involved in this, we know Bridget Ann Kelly and David Wildstein at the Port Authority were involved. We know that for a fact. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. Now, David Wildstein can't, under his own judgment, close two lanes of the George Washington Bridge. We're talking about a bridge in the world that has the most traffic of any other bridge. We're talking about a bridge that links New Jersey, a huge state, to the most populous city in the entire world. Well, in the United States, not the world. We're talking about the closure of two lanes that, when this was done, blocked off traffic during rush hour, opening school week, Jewish holiday, that tied up the Brooklyn Bridge for four straight days. Now, let me give you a picture here. New Jersey, the portion of New Jersey that one of the areas that you can cross the Brooklyn Bridge, one of the areas that you can cross into Jersey, from Jersey to Manhattan, to New York City, not Manhattan, and then vice versa, cross from New York back to Jersey, is one of the largest, the busiest corridors in this country. Fort Lee, this little city that's right at the foot of the Brooklyn Bridge, has approximately 70,000 cars that go through the city as a shortcut to get a closer entrance to New York City. So they go through Fort Lee in the mornings and at night coming home. Who were complaining to the mayor, Sokoloff, during that entire week? They could not get out of their own driveways. They could not get out of their own driveways. Kids going to school on school buses for the first time sat in school buses 4 hours or more, or just about 4 hours or more, to get to school one way. We're talking about 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds. Could not go even to the bathroom because they were locked in the school bus. We're talking about parents wondering where their children were. Some buses didn't even make it off the block that they picked up the kids because of the traffic was that bad. Under normal circumstance, it's a major problem. But this went beyond the pale. So, who's the next person that knew about this? Well, David Wildstein reports to somebody else over at the Port Authority. He reported to the Bill Baroni. Bill Baroni is the person who was appointed by Chris Christie to be the liaison with him and the Port Authority. Then you have David Sampson, who was appointed by Chris Christie, who is the handpicked chairman of the Port Authority. Okay? Handpicked chairman. They all knew. Now, the Port Authority is a bi-state operation. The other side, New York operates. So, and what they do, I believe it's every few years or whoever is the senior governor gets to appoint the chairman, and the other person gets the executive director, who actually operates everything. His name was Foy. He was appointed by Cuomo. He knew nothing about this. Okay? So, just like what was said in the rehash of what you can't handle the truth, remember, Colonel Mason Jessup told the prosecutor that if you don't take orders, people die. That's what he said. People die. And Tom Cruise, who played the prosecutor, and he said, well, you want me to read that back to you? You said, if people don't listen to orders, people die. He said, yes, I know what it says. Well, then why didn't these people listen if he never gave an order to do this? They did this on their own? Maybe we need to just play this little clip from You Can't Handle the Truth one more time. Just listen what we said.
Colonel.
You snotty little bastard.
Your Honor, I'd like to ask for a recess.
I'd like an answer to the question, Judge.
The court will wait for an answer.
If Lieutenant Kendrick gave an order that Santiago wasn't to be touched, then why did he have to be transferred? Colonel, Lieutenant Kendrick ordered the code red, didn't he? Because that's what you told Lieutenant Kendrick to do.
Object! And when it went bad, you
okay.
Cut these guys loose!
Your Honor, you have
Marcus inside a phony transfer!
Your Honor,
you doctored the logbook!
Damn it,
Captain! You coerced the doctor!
Consider yourself in contempt!
Colonel Jessup! Did you order the code red?
You don't have to answer that question.
I'll answer the question. You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth! Son, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's going to do it? You? You, Lieutenant Weinberg? I have a greater responsibility than you can possibly fathom. You weep for Santiago, and you curse the Marines. You have that luxury. You have the luxury of not knowing what I know, that Santiago's death, while tragic, probably saved lives. And my existence...
So the point I'm trying to get here is, why would these people, with all the power that Chris Christie has, disobey any order that he gave and not follow it? And exactly what happened, as soon as they got caught, he cut them loose. He cut Bridget Kelly loose, called her a liar. David Wildstein, granted, they weren't the best of friends, but he went to school with him. He appointed him to the Port Authority. cut him loose. Bill Sepion, his political advisor, who he was going to appoint as the next head of the RNC, as the chairman of the RNC, cut him loose. And he said, these people, I can't understand that, why they did this to me. Me, why they lied to me. Why did they lie to me? What did I do? I don't accept anybody that lies to me. I gave them 1 hour to come up with the truth. I give you 1 hour. You'll have a meeting and come back to me with the truth. This is a man, as was said in the movie Red October, when the whole idea about the captain of this nuclear-powered submarine, Red October, was going to go rogue and disobey the chain of command. The commander of the aircraft carrier said, nuclear submarine commanders don't take a dump without orders from the commander. This is beyond belief.
Hey, Mike, you know, any of these old-style political machines, these states that run like this, and New Jersey is an example of a state that's run that way for quite a long time. There was I'd asked people to read an article by Joseph Dan Fanny that was in the LA Times about 3 days ago. It was talking about kind of their long record of sleaze in New Jersey, if you will, these political machines.
Absolutely.
And you know, I came from Mississippi.
Democrat and Republican.
Yeah, it's the style. You know, you remember Louisiana had a, you know, Huey Long and people like that, right? So they were talking about this, you know, in the past, things like Frank Haig is the boss of Hudson County. He had a desk that the drawers were specially built on that when he pushed it somewhere, it would go out toward the person sitting across from him instead of coming toward him so they could drop in envelopes of graph. And he made over $10 million by the time he retired.
This
is long-standing, you know, right? So, but the thing is about these, just like they were talking about, you know, Tony Soprano, they mentioned in that, you know, one of these fictitious bosses. But the thing with all of these, just as you know, just as you're talking about the examples you gave earlier, it's kind of like Putin's Russia. There's corruption everywhere. There's people doing everything on their own because it's a corrupt system. However, nothing occurs without
the boss.
The boss saying it.
Absolutely.
You don't just go out and do whatever you want and, you know, steal and graft and all without his permission. And there's no way that something like shutting down the major bridge into New York City or whatever is allowable without his say-so. And so it's ridiculous on its face.
Well, it's now past that now because the subpoenas have gone out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and now,
the U.S.
now
attorney,
they're digging into his re-election.
Well,
everything.
Here's the thing now. That Chris Christie, now here's the two things. I've been listening to MSNBC and CNN, all these notch, because they are not giving you the scoop. CNN and MSNBC, but more or less MSNBC, who broke this whole thing on Richard Maddow, but also on, what's his name? Oh, gosh. Chrissy's show. It's, his name. Let's see if I can look it up here. What am I not knowing this guy's name? Pretty cool. What's your name? The guy, Steve Komacki. Steve Komacki. Now, you see, he broke it. He's a New Jersey newsman. That's where he came from. He knows that the bodies are buried.
He's heard about them. An old school reporter.
That's right.
He can dig up information.
And the thing is that Chris Christie now was hoping in some way, shape, or form that the special prosecutor would come in, the special prosecutor or the U.S. prosecutor would come in immediately involved in this, because everything would be held under the table and under the carpet. There would be a news blackout. And he thought that would give him time to make all the changes and put the bodies under the rug and everything else.
And also,
by the time it would hide everything.
So
and to spin it, right. But he didn't want to. He said, oh, good, that the legislature and the assembly are going to have two different investigations. But he got fooled there when the assembly and the legislature combined their subpoena power, and they have this gentleman who was the one who got Blagojevich in Chicago, and he also got Tony Rusko. So
this guy doesn't play around.
This guy don't play around.
But here's the thing about Republicans that drive me nuts, and this is, again, it's going to happen. They're trying for Christie. Just like this instant denial. I had no idea. You mean the bridge is shut down? What? You know, and firing the underlings for doing this. We've heard it before. Every time. You know, if something good would have occurred, you know, it was Chris Christie out there doing it. But the fact that something corrupt happened, it's the same way with, you know, Reagan, with anybody else. There, you know, you mean we've been transferring guns and drugs to the Sandinistas?
No.
What? Huh? Iran?
What? You mean,
so
you mean
as
just good gambling going on here?
It's just like Cheney and them, you know. They threw his assistant under the bus and said, Cheney had nothing to do with it. We're outing CIA spies? That's not a federal crime. Why? How dastardly, you know. Now you go and throw yourself on the sword. It's the Ollie North syndrome. And I hope they don't let him get away with it, because I get tired of it. Year after year, these Republican bosses, every time they get caught, they throw whatever staffer they can to the wolves and then walk off unscathed.
Well, absolutely. The thing is that now, since the assembly has now brought in the big man to handle all this information, and to do the investigation for the state assembly, they are really going to be up the creek. And I'm looking for I don't remember his name. He's the new attorney for the state. And I can't remember his name. See if you can look at his name there. And he is going to be involved in getting the investigations. They sent out 20 subpoenas, but what's really happened?
Paul Fishman?
He's the attorney for the feds. The attorney for the assembly. It's oh, gosh, I can't remember his name. But anyway, you can find it. The one who prosecuted the case for against Tony Rusko and
Blagojevich,
right. But anyway, so what has happened now is that the subpoenas have gone out, and according to...
is it Reed Shar?
Yes, Reed Shar. That's the man's name. Reed Shar is...
Yeah. He's the one they finally brought down. Rod... The
right,
blog.
Right. So Richard now is going to be handling all this. And as we first saw, he was supposed to, the assembly was only going to issue 3 subpoenas. The first day he was there, he says, don't issue no subpoenas. The next day, 20 went out. He said, you just can't answer, just ask these people here. Because we want all the emails. We want all the text messages. Mm-hmm. We want the whole 9 yards. They could hide behind stuff. Now, here's the problem. Chris Christie knows. He was a U.S. attorney.
Yeah, he knows how to hide. Maybe.
But here's the thing now. According to the, let's see, do I have that here? According to let's see. According to what we have here, according to the what was said about And this really is going to be coordinated with Bob McDonnell case, bribery and court bribery in a case like this with federal corruption is hard to prove. But what they did in 1988 passed what they call the Honest Service Fraud Act. And the Honest Service Fraud Act says that the federal mail and wire fraud, this is, definitely goes with federal mail and wire. That means, and the wire could be text messages, could be emails. Okay. For the purpose of this chapter, the term scheme or artifice to defraud includes a scheme or artifice deprived by depriving of another of the intangible rights of an honest service. The statute has been applied by federal prosecutors in cases of public corruption, as well as cases in which private individuals breached their duty, fiduciary duty, to another. In the form of the courts, notably have been divided on this question of whether a state law violation is necessary honest services fraud to have occurred. In the latter, the courts notably have taken different approaches in determining whether the private individual has committed honest fraud. Now, according to the Supreme Court of the United States, in the case of Schilling versus the United States, in order to avoid finding the statute to be unconstitutional and vague, interpreted the statute to only cover fraudulent schemes to deprive another of honest services through bribes, kickbacks, supplies by a third party, and who have not been deceived. However, the High Court said that kickbacks or bribery have to be involved when prosecutors use this law.
Right.
Now, the problem is that they do not have to prove that he actually got money in his hand.
Right.
They just have to prove whether or not it took place.
And here's the thing, though, that's going to bite him, I think. This is where he's going to get into trouble. It isn't that he just went to Podunk County and, you know, stopped a traffic off of a little bridge.
That's right.
Know, swinging bridge across the ancient river there. No. He blocked interstate commerce between two states. That's very different. And in the other case that they're looking into now, he apparently is withholding
federal
funding from disaster relief.
That's correct.
Now, both of those are federal. It's not just like he's screwing around and his, you know, being his little fiefdom in
but
New Jersey.
Homeland Security is involved in this, too, because
so,
the George Washington Bridge is one of the 20 places in the United States that's covered as a designated terrorist place to blow up.
Right. And evacuation route.
Absolutely.
So, when you got those, see, so that's it, but it's multi-state and it's national.
Well,
so those are those problems. And then the other thing I think is going to bite him in the ass, because that expands it beyond just a New
correct.
Jersey problem. The other thing is, even though he's, you know, prosecuting, he knows better than to leave a quote-unquote paper trail. The problem these days is, I think technology is going to help bite him in the ass, because in the old days, you know, you shred those files, you get rid of that stuff, you're done. You protected yourself. Nowadays, with all the permanent record that we have of digital records, something's going to be left somewhere, even if he deletes.
Well, I don't think they're going to find digital trail with him to any one of these cronies, because I'm sure he did face-to-face. But the problem is you need one person to turn witness.
Mm-hmm. And then you're screwed.
Right. And now, but we're going to get back to this
a
lot more.
Throwing these guys under the bus, somebody might just say, I'm not going.
Correct. Well, right now we're going to change up just a little because we have a strong two people who are coming on our show right now. And hello, who's this?
Hi, Mike. It's Matt Newton.
And who else do I have on here?
Michael, Jay Holman, how are you?
Okay, we have Matt Newton, who is really noted for in Charlotte for helping to get the Civilian Review Board to do what they need to do in Charlotte, North Carolina.
That's a major reform.
Major reform. And we also have Mr. Holman, who is with the National Action Network. And, gentlemen, I would just like to introduce you by what has happened here in Charlotte with the shooting of Jonathan Ferrell. It's a North Carolina grand jury has declined to indict Officer Randall Perrick on charges of voluntary manslaughter in the shooting death of Jonathan Ferrell. This happened this past Tuesday. Today, the prosecutors learned that the grand jury that considered the indictment on the charges of voluntary manslaughter was less than a full panel. It would be in the best interest of the justice to resubmit this case. And this is according to Attorney General Roy Cooper, who is the Attorney General of the state of North Carolina. Chris Chestnut, an attorney for the Ferrell family, said that family members felt hurt and betrayed because of the grand jury's decision. We were shocked and devastated. We thought it would be the duty. It would be a day of justice. We are highly concerned that a miscarriage of justice is imminent. Now, before I'd like to tell you about a conversation I had with a very good journalist here from the Charlotte Observer, Mr. Michael Gordine, today. He has been writing up this whole storyline, and I had a long talk with him, and he couldn't come on the show today, but we're looking to see if we can get him on the show for next week. In speaking to him, he was a little bit shocked himself that this happened. He says it happens on rare occasions. Now, I've been doing a major look into the statute of what the grand jury and how it's supposed to operate. North Carolina has 18 grand juries. Now, to vote for indictment, that means 12 out of the 18 need to vote for indictment, and they can get an indictment. I should say three. If three say, or four, I should say, if four do not want an indictment, they don't get an indictment. So it's either you get the four that don't, or you get the 12 that do. In this case, they only had 14 members. So that meant there was a higher chance that they wouldn't get an indictment.
Right.
Now, why that? As a matter of fact, I'm not sure if the DA who tried the case was even there. And we're talking about someone, Coleman, I believe. Is that his name, Matt?
Yeah, I'm not sure the name. I know that there was a special prosecutor and also a member of the police department who had presented the evidence that they had, and we don't know the extent of that evidence, but had presented the case to 14 members, I believe, of a grand jury.
Well, and as a lawyer, Matt, talking to Mr. Gordine, he said that, you know, you now, because you have less than 14, you now, it's a harder chance to indict. But even then, I mean, you're more apt to get hit by a meteorite than a grand jury not indicting you. Let me finish it. The major thing that I said to Mr. Gordine today, I said, you're a lawyer. The first thing you learn in law school is you never ask a question that you don't have an answer to. So how do you go to a grand jury and not get a verdict in your favor?
Mm-hmm.
Matt?
explain.
Yeah, the process is completely one-sided. A presentment of evidence to a grand jury is made by the prosecution, and you don't have the regular rules of evidence apply. And so hearsay, any other types of otherwise excludable information is presented in its entirety to the grand jury. That's what makes this so mind-blowing. Many folks in the community were calling for a heightened charge. And so I think that there was disappointment from the get-go that the Attorney General, Roy Cooper, didn't elevate the voluntary manslaughter charge to second-degree murder. Now, having said that, and I think that would have been a charge that could have been elevated and would have been applicable to a common citizen. But having said that, it makes it that much more shocking and bewildering the fact that the voluntary manslaughter charge did not result in an indictment.
Well, the thing is that I understand that the district attorney here in Charlotte is with the same law firm as with the defense attorney, so that's why he excused himself from the case. But Roy Cooper, as the attorney general, could not bulldoze his way into this case like Chris Christie, unless he's asked to by someone who would be, in this particular case, a special prosecutor. So now they have done that. So the thing that I need to ask you, that what is the steps now that would take place for Roy Cooper to reindict Kerrick?
Well, it's just a resubmittance of the evidence to the grand jury. Prosecutors have the right to do that. Now there is a what would be considered a lesser included offense, which would be involuntary manslaughter. But it's my understanding that what will happen on Monday is the special prosecutor, along with the representative of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, will have a new and fully impaneled grand jury. So it won't be the same folks from this past Tuesday, and they will be striving to have the full 18 members of the grand jury impaneled. And they will go back through the evidence once again. And hopefully this time there will be the indictment.
Okay, well, but now can the grand jury, because this particular grand jury sent it back and said we'd like a lesser charge, can the attorney general now say, no, there's no way. I'm going to up the charge. Can he do that?
Sure. The attorney general could resubmit it would be considered an amended charge. Could resubmit an amended charge that's higher on Monday if he so chooses. He could also admit the lesser included charge, so a less severe charge on Monday. It sounds like from the very beginning, and I wanted to reiterate. There were a lot of community organizers and organizations. So a lot of the folks that I worked with on the Citizens Review Board reform movement, who were calling for the charge to be heightened, the original voluntary manslaughter charge to be heightened to second degree murder, and it's something that the evidence we have, and granted the general public doesn't have all the facts. And I think there could potentially be issues with that, because that is one of the sources of confusion and could be a further source of an erosion of the public trust. But despite that, the facts we have could make the argument that a second-degree murder charge could be leveled, right? It doesn't necessarily mean that any jury, impaneled jury at trial, would convict of second-degree murder, but at the very least, the charge could nonetheless be leveled, and the argument could be made. And so that's something that that Roy Cooper could do on resubmittance to the grand jury, but it doesn't sound like will be done. And then again, too, I think that under the circumstances, we can only hope that justice is served. There's always, if if the grand jury comes back with a non-indictment again, then it can be resubmitted for a third time. But I think the greater likelihood is that it will be resubmitted for involuntary manslaughter. The difference being a sentence that could fluctuate from the ballpark of 3 to 8 years down to 1 to 3, or not a single day in jail at all.
Okay, I want to back up just a little bit. Jay, can you take us through this whole saga, how it originated to where we are right now, as far as the shooting goes?
Well, Michael, there are a lot of issues that are out there that are gray areas. And one of them, of course, being the actual shooting itself. Now, according to what we hear, right, there were 12 shots fired. Now, there's some gray area in there about a pause during the middle of that. Now, imagine, walk with me through this scene, if you will. Here's a group of police officers standing around. One officer pulls his weapon, right, and fires 12 shots at a suspect. Now, my law enforcement training when I was in the United States Navy limited us to a 10-clip gun. So the 12-shot theory, right, in my mind raises the first question, did he actually stop, switch clips, and then continue to fire? That's a gray area. I'm not going to speculate on that, however. I'm just looking at the numbers in my mind.
Well, isn't the clip, I thought it held 15 in these Glocks, right?
Well, I'm not sure if what the standard equipment issue is for Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police. I know normal police agencies have a 10 clip.
It's a 40 caliber Glock, right?
Yeah, 40 caliber M&P Smith and Wesson is what they carry. I'm not sure. It's either 12 or 15.
Okay.
Clip. I'm not sure. Now I could find out and get that information back to you.
Okay.
Okay.
And even if we go to the 12 clip, right, or the 15 round clip, at some point in time, in my mind, right, your body after shooting 8 rounds is fatigued to the point where it's like you really want to shoot off 4 more, and there comes a quick judgment call. Right, how many rounds does it take for an unarmed male, black male, approaching you to make him stop? Now, here's the other side of the coin. Two of the other officers supposedly drew tasers. Now, understanding he's unarmed, shouldn't the taser have been the first call? That, of course, is a judgment that's being held right there on the scene. But going back to the grand jury's failure to indict, I find it interesting that over the course of the last year, 278 cases came before that grand jury, and of the 278 cases, only 2 did they fail to indict, and one of them being Curry. So basically, this grand jury is sitting there, and they're indicting everything from petty larceny to grand theft auto. But the obvious murder, they want lesser charge.
The other one that wasn't indicted, do you know what that case was?
I am not sure that, Mike. I saw it. I read it not too long ago. I can't. I'm not familiar. I want to say it was a larceny case, but.
It wasn't a killing.
No, it wasn't a killing. And this was a killing.
Yeah. Well, see, here's the question I have. How far was Perrick from Farrell when he fired the shot? Do they know? I told you?
Matt, I'm not sure on that. Matt.
Reports have suggested that it was at close range. Close enough to practically, if not be, but be point blank. And you're talking about the two pauses is is reports have indicated, and you're talking about the penetration of 10 rounds into the core region of Mr. Farrell's body, five of those by themselves being located in a way that could have been by themselves fatal. So, certainly kill shots.
At that close range, wouldn't those bullets have gone through him?
I don't know, Mike. We don't have all the information. I think the most telling piece of evidence is the videotape that hasn't been provided to the public. And I think that this is an instance where we can second guess the judgment and verdict of the grand jury on Tuesday, but it would really, really be beneficial for the community at large to have that piece of information to view on its own. And there is certainly a selective dissemination of information that police departments across the state engage in. And I think that's an issue that we can look at and needs to be addressed in light of this particular matter.
I agree.
Well, here's a rather stupid but just obvious question. Is it the defense that the man was attacking and they were also threatened that they had to just keep firing and stop this guy no matter what? Or is it their contention that it's just kind of, hey, it's a semi-automatic clip and it was so fast we didn't even know the 10 bullets had gone before I stopped pulling the trigger, you know, that type of defense? I mean, what is the concept of shooting anyone 10 times in a row? I don't follow.
Exactly. And neither does anybody else. Neither does anybody else. The thing is just like Matt was saying, if the dash cam was made available, if this video was made available, then it would maybe explain something in our minds and explain deeper to the family exactly what the officer's justification was for firing 10 times. I've been in situations, I did two tours in Iraq, and I honestly can tell you that there was no subject that came up before me that I had to fire 12 bullets at. None.
Right. I mean, that's the part that I'm just having trouble with to begin with. Even if you felt threatened, maybe, you know, one or two or three or four or something, but, you know, 10 or 12, you just get
the concept. The concept of self-defense is multifaceted. There are different elements to it. You as an individual, so long, and of course we have a variation of standard ground here in North Carolina, but despite that expanded castle doctrine here, the standard ground castle doctrine, you as an individual have a duty to retreat outside of the parameters of that particular law, and In the absence of that, you have the ability to respond in self-defense to equal or respond with an equal amount of force that is being conveyed towards yourself. We have to accept the argument that this particular officer, who was simply being advanced at by an unarmed, clearly unarmed man, felt that his life was in danger, and that it required 12 shots to save his life, and to jump to that particular conclusion, it would seem to be extreme. But I think even furthermore would suggest at the very least there was a use of excessive force here, and that's something that our own chief of police has publicly stated. If you want to go beyond that and you want to say that as I said before, there were five bullets that entered Mr. Farrell's body that could have been the fatal bullet. We don't know if that started on bullet six or if it started on bullet one. But if you want to go further and say that the threat to Officer Farrell, or I'm sorry, Officer Carrick, was completely dispelled by the fatal bullet, then what you're saying is that he at that point had engaged in an intent to kill and no longer needed to exhibit self-defense. That's second-degree murder.
Right.
And there we have it.
Here's another generic public-to-police question. we just came off of an unbelievable occurrence out in L.A. with another, murder of someone with the handicapped man, mentally handicapped man. But with this situation here, do you think this falls under that rubric of, close the door and protect the police at all costs? Or is it just somehow some absolute fluke that we're not being allowed to see the video, not being allowed to even investigate or indict?
Well, I honestly think one of the main reasons that we're probably not seeing the video in this particular case is because the evidence is so compelling, right? I mean, if the common reasonable man were to sit there and look at the video, it would be clear cut. Now, I have to applaud the police department for their swiftness in charging Carrick with, involuntary manslaughter. It's a clear message that, no, we're not above the law. But right. When you look at the charge itself, how the procedure went after that, there's a lot of areas there where transparency and full disclosure of information obviously failed during the process, and we failed to get an indictment.
So then does the charge just become like a preemptive PR campaign?
It could have been a preemptive strike in all actuality. That's the other side. Mike, if we saw the tape, we would all look at it and say, and as Matt said, after the sixth shot, this is an intent to kill. This is second-degree murder.
Okay, but see, the question I have...
That's like saying the body's still moving because
right.
The bullets are still hitting it.
If the Charlotte police chief, Rodney Moore, said, this was murder, how come the grand jury said this is overkill in an indictment? I mean, you don't even take the police chief's word? So his word means nothing? I mean, it just doesn't even make any common sense.
And you would presume that he saw the video. He's the police chief.
He saw the video.
He would have to make
probably
the judgment
before
call.
Everybody else did, before the DA saw it.
Yeah, the baseline here is voluntary manslaughter. And
I know,
for whatever
but
reason,
wanted, the police chief wanted. So, of the police chief disregard what he said and say, okay, we're gonna work it down to this. I mean, and this is what bothers me about this guy Murray, who's the DA here. I mean, he's worked same law firm. Is Carrick's lawyer. So
right.
Is there collusion here?
What a coincidence.
Gee.
I would like to point out that the district attorney is up for election this year.
Well, yeah, but it's just like Chris Christie hiring David Sampson over at the Port Authority, and now David Sampson says, hey, what bridge was closed down? Are you kidding me? He just doesn't even make sense. He just don't pass the smell test whatsoever.
They're saying, did we know you? I don't know you. You're at the same firm?
And what's Murray's name? What's his
Andrew
first
name? Murray. Andrew Murray.
I've got
Murray.
Matt. I hate to go with you. I just had a quick question to something that's playing around in my mind. If you send a charge of involuntary manslaughter to the grand jury looks at the evidence. Can the grand jury send a charge of murder too? Can it indict on murder too? Or does it have to go with the charge that was submitted by the DA?
Can they elevate the charge?
Again,
it would be a recommendation for the elevation, a recommendation to amend to the elevated charge. They themselves can't do it. It's up to the special prosecutor or the district attorney to do that.
Okay. So they could look at the evidence and send the recommendation back.
Just as seldomly as we see non-indictments happen, it's similarly just as seldomly or rare to see the district attorney not take the most serious or elevated charge to the grand jury in the first place. I think, getting back to that point before, I think that we would have expected that the charge to be taken to the grand jury would have been second-degree murder, and I think that would have been the case for other citizens. That wasn't the case here, and once again, it's that much more shocking and disheartening, the outcome. I wanted to touch on the fact, too, the discrepancy in the dissemination of information to the public. We did receive the 911 tapes, but once again, the most important piece of information to help us understand would be the videotape. And that was something that was obtained within the public domain. Had you been standing on the street corner, you would have seen the same exact thing that videotape would show. And the 911 tape couldn't be any much or any more further from that. You know, we're talking about a phone call that was made in private to a 911 dispatcher who received it in a private setting, yet that has been released, whereas the claim for not having the videotape released is the fact that it is now confidential, part of a personnel file. And in those two concepts don't seem to coincide. Why release one and not the other, especially when you have something like this happen and there's so many questions left unanswered?
Well, Judge Bona said that Farrell's death has already drawn an excessive amount of media attention. You think? Okay, this case should be decided in the courtroom and not in the Charlotte Observer. Okay, but the thing is that James Comey, who's the senior deputy attorney general, now has the say on whether or not the public sees the video, according to a consent order signed by Superior Court Judge Richard Bonner. The agreement involving Comey, Kerrick's defense attorney, and CMPD overrides a state law that gives city manager Ron Koch authority to release the video if necessary. Now, Bonner, this is what Bonner says now, said the file, he then signed a court order ordering and declaring that no evidence material shall be released except North Carolina Attorney General's office if he appropriate. Now,
so they made a special case code around the law,
right,
just to keep this thing.
So, I mean, what the heck is going on here? How do you get back on a grand jury, one, in a murder case where you only get 14 panel members, two, then get the grand jury to not to indict? This is almost like something Mission Impossible would do, infiltrate the jury and get it to go the other way. This is beyond reality. And this Judge Bonner needs to answer some questions on this.
Right.
I mean, it's just completely outrageous.
And again, the person who has seen it, Police Chief Rodney Moore,
right,
Roman, he said
it was murder,
that it was a clear case of excessive force.
Right.
And so that, I mean, again, the people who have seen it and who have spoken publicly are saying it needs to be different. So it makes you wonder. Makes you wonder. But does this have anything to do with that this is the first case in 30 years with the police? Or what? I mean,
first case of what? Police shooting?
Yeah.
Murder. No.
Yeah. Is it first in
no,
30 years?
No. How many police shootings we had, Matt?
This was 20. Number six. This is number six within a two-year period.
That's right.
What we did, the coalition for CRB reform, to reform the Citizens Review Board, we looked at the expenditures of the police department, their overall budget size, their expenditures, and we cross-referenced that with the number of shooting, officer-related shooting deaths in over 15 years. And what we saw was that there was a drop although the overall budget of the police department increased by $5 million per year, over the past 4 years, there has been a significant drop in the expenditures for community services as well as in the expenditures for officer training. During that same period of time, there has been a spike, an outright spike, in the numbers of officer-related shooting deaths, culminating, of course, in the death of Mr. Farrell. And I think what's significant here is there have been shooting deaths in the past, but this is about as egregious and outrageous as it gets. 12 shots, 10 making contact with Mr. Farrell, who happened to be an unarmed motorist seeking help. You couldn't have said, and granted, one more significant point here, it's on tape. You couldn't have had a worst-case scenario or outcome, and that's why this is something that needs to be thoroughly and seriously prosecuted so that the message is sent that this is something that will not be tolerated. And we cannot have this fall back on the taxpayer, whereby officers and Officer Carrick is exonerated, and we, the taxpayer, have to foot the bill in the civil system without true accountability for the individual officer.
Well, there's two other things that I read recently was that, well, one, half the shots were fired at a downward angle, like he was on the ground or at his knees.
Well, you know, if
you know anything about that?
You've been shot five times, you probably are on your knees or on the ground.
And then if he was at such close range, couldn't he see there was nothing in his hands?
Again, those are the questions, Mike, that we're raising across dinner tables all over Charlotte, because despite the involvement, this isn't just simply a black and white issue. This goes to concern to every citizen of Charlotte. And if every citizen of Charlotte is not outraged by this, then that alone is scary. Because, like we were saying, the first six rounds, you know, if he's already fallen to the ground, if he's at such close range, we have no weapon, he's no longer posing a threat, then what were the other six rounds for?
I mean, and what were the other two police officers doing? Picking their nose?
Playing with their tasers.
I mean, what were they doing?
We'd have to look at the dash cam to see that.
I mean, that this is completely outrageous.
Well, here's the part that, again, getting back to, you know, I think he was hitting it on the head. You see a direct correlation that when you don't invest in training and you don't have community services, you start having more and more problems like this, we'll say, and proper training. And it kind of, not to be light about it, but it kind of gets back to that joke. You know, if you go 4 miles over the speed limit, a police officer suddenly behind you pulls you over. But if you're broken down on the side of the road, they blast high at 60 miles an hour and never stop to ask if you need help, you know, when you're out there trying to change a tire or something. So community service, you know, that whole part of the tech that serves the community seems to be missing sometimes. In police work nowadays, it's all about, you know, terror drills and new equipment and riding around in our SWAT vehicles and kind of attacking the public, not serving the public.
So
that's what I'm worried.
So what is being said here is that Carrick decided he was not going to get killed, even though the other two officers, he said, well, they ain't drawing their guns. They're going to die, but I ain't. I mean, I don't understand that. I mean, I thought the first thing you do was pull your taser. And isn't that closer to their hand than the gun? Because the gun is supposed to be
All their non-lethal.
Not sheltered in.
You know, they usually have the batons or the tasers and stuff, or the sprays, pepper spray even, to take care of things when you're just in a crowd and you're trying to control somebody or drunk or something. You don't just walk up and start blasting.
And the other question I have, was this in the dark, no lights? They couldn't see him running in the dark? Has that been
again,
said?
Michael, that's a question of getting the dash cam to see exactly what their perspective of it was. But even still, right, we're still looking at the excessive amount of force that was used by Officer Couric in comparison to the amount of force or the amount of effort that was put forward by the other two officers that were also there on the scene. A reasonable man looking at the situation has his doubts.
And if you have three police cruisers there running with their headlights on, it was lit up like the Super Bowl. So they had in his hand. Jay, tell us what the National Action Network is involved with doing now because of this.
As it stands right now, the National Action Network here in North Carolina, Charlotte chapter, along with the NAACP and several other civil rights organizations, has set a rally for Monday morning at 9 o'clock in front of the courthouse. We want to be there when the members of the grand jury panel walk into that building and be there until they walk out, until that verdict is read. We will stand by, we'll be vigilant, we will watch to see, to make sure that justice is served. We don't want to interrupt the process. We just want to make sure that the process is fair and it's just.
General Cooper coming here himself?
Hey, Mike, let me read this to you real quick.
You know? Is Roy Cooper coming here himself, or is he sending one of his...
That I'm really not sure at this stage. I understand that there are people that are talking to Cooper, but as far as whether or not he will actually be present on Monday, I am not sure of that. I would guess, given the gravity of the situation, that he would be.
Yeah.
God knows if I was him, I would be.
You want to be governor.
Just for the factual side of things, I was just going to say, I saw, just looking on a news report online about the event, and it says, Farrell had been in a car wreck that nobody knew about at the time. Anyway, he was going to houses on the street. He was knocking on doors. One woman who lived there looked out, thought it was her husband, then saw it was a stranger, had called 911. They arrived, found Farrell walking a short distance from the home and had matched the description given by the homeowner in the same clothes. So when they called on him, he turned and started running toward them. They actually shot him with a taser, and when he kept coming, the other guy pulled his gun and shot him 12 times. That's what
now,
this report says.
Well, I
so
now,
then
I,
that means
I have this, not heard that.
Well, this is in this report that I'm just reading.
Yeah,
online.
Well,
but they said
that, who's that from?
Let's see.
Because to everything that I've heard so far, that these other officers never cleared leather at all with a taser or a gun.
Here you go, Fox News.
Oh, it's Fox News. See, now,
but,
come on.
If that, yeah, but could they just make up a fact?
Yes, they can make up a fact. They do it every single day. Fox News makes up a fact. If there's no fact, they'll make up a fact to fit something that didn't even happen yet. Forget Fox News. I mean, come on.
Well, I'm just trying to ascertain if they used the taser.
Don't go to Fox News to ascertain if it's dark or light out. Please. we need some, look out the window yourself unless you're blind, and then... listen to your time call.
What I'm impressed about, though, is that this lady called 911 and there was at least three cops responding.
Right.
That's phenomenal. When I call 911, the next day I see one that a
Where
job.
Did this take place at, Jay? What side of town?
The far east side. It was over towards Reedy Creek.
Yeah. Okay. It was near where?
Towards Reedy Creek. East of Reedy Creek, so between Reedy Creek and the county border.
Oh, okay, all right, okay. All right. In those areas over there, the lighting ain't that good, but with three cruisers out there, you could play a baseball game with the lights they have on those cars. So it couldn't be that he couldn't see the man, didn't have anything in him. And this is the first time I've heard, and I've never read an account that these guys didn't clear leather with their gun or tasers. Everything remained, and they were bystanders. And as a matter of fact, the police chief never would have said that if he if it was true that they shot him with a taser, because in his question, the police chief never mentions the taser.
Mm-hmm. And you would think he would have to in order to justify elevating the use of force.
Absolutely correct.
If you use a taser and the subject continues to move forward, right, then, of course, taking it to the next level would have been pulling the revolver. You would think that fact that it existed would have came out.
Or everybody shooting him with a taser.
Yeah.
Right.
Three taser
shots.
Let's
keep in mind, too, we're talking about somebody, and reports have suggested that he showed his hands, he was clearly unarmed. And
yes.
And so there's somebody with no weapon whatsoever, and this is a distinction to be made from reports of previous officer-related shooting incidents. Even when Michael Delaney was shot in the head, although he was facing the ground, he allegedly had a gun. That was next to his person. In this particular instance, we're talking about someone who was clearly unarmed. So does that person, when you have three officers on scene, does that rise to the level of any particular officer feeling their life being threatened, right, and having to respond with deadly force as quickly and as soon as he did? That is, I think, a huge question to be raised and something that creates a real problem for anyone that would suggest that this should be less than voluntary manslaughter, and I think builds the case for second degree murder.
And Tarek doesn't even say he had a weapon.
Right, he doesn't. Tarek said he had a weapon.
That's right. So. You're telling me you're going to shoot somebody who doesn't have a weapon and you have two other officers there with you if he jumps on you and starts beating you to the ground?
I'm looking at New York Times, the same thing. Mm-hmm. They said they tried to stop him with the taser first, then shot him.
Yeah, they probably got it from Fox News.
But here's the other thing that it says. This is interesting here. New York Times reporting that they said that, because they talked to police departments around the country, that all the police departments and the Fraternal Order of Police were highly, highly pissed that they charged him. So, because they said your usual case, you would charge an officer weeks or months afterwards after an investigation is done. He was charged within hours.
Yeah, because they looked at the videotape.
Yeah. But they said that this made and police departments mad all over the country, and they said they were all looking at this case because they said it would have a chilling effect on police officers doing their job. If they could be charged immediately, you know, with crimes.
Yeah.
So they said the Fraternal Order of Police could even come against this. So
I don't think 12 rounds is him doing his job, okay? I'm sorry. I understand that the state serves to stand, but 12 rounds is not doing your job.
That's probably the union saying
it. Well, yeah, they said the Fraternal Order of Police.
Okay, well,
I'm just trying to find a reason maybe they brought pressure on the grand jury or something. I'm trying to find a reason why they just threw this out without.
The police chief said, as soon as he saw the videotape, it is excessive force.
Right, that's why he charged him within hours.
So, forget it.
However,
why did
they then back off? And I'm just saying, maybe they're having pressure.
No,
everyone knows that police work is a dangerous occupation. Any officer who becomes a police officer, an officer should expect and assume that responsibility. So to say that you shouldn't be held to that higher standard, I think is disingenuous. What we need to do, because these are trained professionals, and what we need to do is we need to hold them to the standard of a trained professional. And unfortunately, I believe that the charge and the verdict by the grand jury doesn't do that, and that's something that we as a society need to reevaluate and be sure that for our own safety and for our own trust of our sacred institution is upheld and that that there is accountability when it's warranted.
Because right. I can guarantee you, Michael. As soon as this happens, right? And I'm a play the card. As soon as this happens to a 22-year-old white male, the situation is going to be different.
Right.
That's just honestly the value that it's reflecting. As soon as this were to happen to a 22-year-old white male, the situation would be handled differently.
Well,
they
would have been running toward the white man saying,
right.
Do you need assistance?
Right.
Are you okay?
Is it true? They wouldn't even taste him.
But the officer can always claim affluence defense.
Yeah, that's right. Like that kid.
See, he can always claim the affluence defense. You know,
right.
I too much money growing up, and I wasn't taught.
Yeah.
Right from wrong.
What's that? He looked
uh-huh. Yeah. Right.
So what are we expected, Matt, on Monday to happen?
Well, the voluntary manslaughter charge will be resubmitted to a brand new grand jury that we hope is present, and you know all 18 members are there, so fully impaneled.
Just a new impaneled, a second grand jury, or the same grand jury?
They alternate every week. There are two separate panels of 18. That hold their positions for a six-month period, and every week they alternate. So this will be a new week, so it will be a completely new group of 18 people, or hopefully up to 18 people, hopefully full 18 in panels.
What is the newspapers going to say if this grand jury comes back and says, indict him?
Yeah, then it's gonna be...
What are they going to say then? What's going to be the first line in the newspapers and on Fox News?
Yeah, depends on the outlet, right, in the news agency.
Okay.
It's, you know, either a political ploy or justice being served. That's where we are. And maybe if there were a fully impaneled grand jury last week, if they had waited, and certainly we don't know the extent of the evidence or the arguments presented to the grand jury, but we could always second guess. However, hopefully this time we can rest assured that it will be done correctly. Not to say it wasn't before, but that it will assuredly be done correctly this time as well. If we go down that road and we'll see the outcome, you know, and take it from there. I'm of the opinion that an indictment is warranted. If not, then certainly help us understand. You know, as a general public, I think it's something that is bewildering, as I said before, and confusing. So hopefully city or other bureaucratic leaders can help the general public understand why not if they do not indict.
Right, and this is one thing that I'd like to kind of point out in the defense, if you will, for the police officer. They're saying he moved toward them. He was running toward them, right, because he was looking for help. Okay, now, if he had been running away from them, they would say he was running away. He was fleeing the scene,
yep.
Right? We had to shoot.
Exactly.
He was going toward them. So, again, that seems kind of, you know, counter to anything. He wasn't fleeing from the police as they arrived on the scene trying to, you know, investigate a potential crime. He's coming toward them. He's doing everything he should. And then you got the further problem, of course, with the shot. That seems like he's already prone or kneeling. But anyway, given all that, whether or not he is indicted or not, say he just gets off, say everything just gets washed under the bridge, you know, and everything's going away. What do we do since, Matt, you just helped us reform our entire review board here, but what could we do to correct these kinds of problems in the future, just community service-wise or education-wise or community involvement-wise? How could we mitigate a future disaster like this?
I think we touched on two very important and key ways earlier of preventing or creating a preventative atmosphere so something like this doesn't happen again. And what we can do initially is we can demand that our city invest more money in officer training and community services, especially in light of the increases in the overall police department budget. Secondly, what we can do is we can further strengthen on a state level, further strengthen the Citizens Review Board, so create additional layers of oversight, and also reform the law that prevents the dissemination of this key essential piece of evidence that is otherwise public. It's General Statute 160A-165. It's the same statute that we faced with the Citizens Review Board movement that prevented or allegedly prevented the review board from having subpoena power. And if that is amended or abolished, what you would find is the ability for the general public to see these videotapes. That there's a reason why they're videotapes, right? And they're there to capture what really happened without any blurriness to it, right? No gray area. It's what happened. And what good are they if we don't have the opportunity to see them? And I think that if it happens in the public domain, if you're someone standing on a street corner watching this happen right in front of you, it's no different than what that video camera is capturing. So it should be available. And if so, then we can ensure that the police are doing their jobs correctly, right? And just to reiterate, maybe the grand jury got this one right, but we will never know because we don't have access to that tape that would otherwise be publicly disclosed.
The thing is, before we go here, but I want you, Jay, I want you to tell us what you're going to be involved with going forth, especially on Monday.
Well, our main concern Monday, right, is trying to get as many people that understand that this is a very, very important issue to come out and just show a show of presence at the Justice Center on Monday to ensure that the impaneled jury, along with the entire justice system there in the city of Charlotte, know that this is something that the people are concerned about. From a community point of view, I think one of the things that I must applaud Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department on doing is continuing to put satellite stations in neighborhoods and everything else. I understand the main purpose for it was to try and control the crime in those neighborhoods, but if we had it to where our police officers, because, I mean, even we were all growing up, we knew who our police officers were in our areas. They knew us. They knew our parents. They knew. And things were handled more personal. And we don't have that anymore. It seems like we have police officers now their sole purpose is to arrest, not to protect, not to serve, and not defend. It's just to arrest. And somewhere in the training process, that mindset needs to change. Because they're a part of our community, and we are that community. And we rely on them. We depend on them to protect, to serve, and to defend. So the relationship that we have is broken, and it needs to be reestablished.
One of the things I was talking about in the L.A. case that was made national news was they said he refused to comply, and that gave justification for the quote-unquote peace officer to use deadly force or whatever because a mentally handicapped person refused to comply with
the
order.
Isn't that an oxymoron, police officer?
Yeah, but that again, gets to this point of they're not defending the public. They're not doing anything to protect the public. It is enforcing the rule, black and white, just enforcing the rule. If you don't follow it to the letter, you're dead. And that's what this case here. The guy was running toward us, so we killed him.
Right.
I mean, that, you know, that,
no,
that gives.
He a, killed him.
Yeah,
they,
I mean, that's,
they,
but that's the we, the police. But that's a problem.
Matt, tell us. I understand you are embarking in another direction, also. Matt.
Yes, I will be filing and running for state senate seat 40. And this is an issue, Thomas, I believe you were asking me a moment ago about what can be done here. Well, this is an issue that we could certainly take to Raleigh and draft legislation to address, just as much so as expanding the powers of the Citizens Review Board, expanding expungement laws, having stronger protections for victims of domestic violence, amongst other issues that I could go on and on about. But I will be running for state senate seat 40.
And that is the seat that is presently held by Senator Malcolm Graham.
By Malcolm Graham. Mm-hmm.
Right. We're going to have you on so you can give us a full-blown account of the play-by-play and what you're going to do. But if someone wanted to help you with your campaign, how can they get in touch with you or find you or to send you some money? Not graft, but some money.
Anyone interested in helping can contact my office at area code 704-280-8493 and can also send a contribution to my office address, 2015 Ayersley, Ayersley, Town Boulevard, Suite 202, Charlotte, North Carolina, 28273.
Well, I just want to say thank you to Jay Holman, who's with the National Public Action Network here in Charlotte, North Carolina, the Charlotte chapter, and is a great activist in the city, and who Matt Newton, who has already struck a blow for humanity and the public with the reforming of the Civilian Review Board. And we're going to have you back on again, Matt, and we'll have you back on again, Jay, when we find out what the Attorney General, Matt Cooper, is going to be doing here next week.
It's been my pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. And I look forward to being back on.
Very good. I want to thank both of you guys, and it's been a pleasure. Look forward to hearing from you very shortly. And that was the what we have so far on the police shooting of Jonathan Farrell, from Florida A&M, the football player there, and dash cam video. We need to see that.
Right. Which is exactly as he said. Why
right.
We have dash cam these days?
That's
very
right.
Traffic stops and everything else. It covers. You know, all the what happened and,
right.
And gets rid of the opinions.
Well, we are going to go on a different subject right now. We have two people holding on, but one of the things that I wanted to play, and I think this is very appropriate. Just listen to this.
Michael? Bigger than U.S. Steel.
Yes, we're bigger than U.S. Steel. And that's what every single president of every college in this country thinks. They're bigger than U.S. Steel.
Well, they are presidents, after all.
They are presidents, after all. Right. Right now we have Mr. George Gaffney, Big Gaff, who is film critic.
Extraordinaire,
basketball extraordinaire, who knows the ins and out of Nike.
Nike. Wow.
And a major film critic in these parts of the country. And we also have Clyde Doggettree, who I think I said doctor. Well, we'll find out. He is a 25-year. He has been the director of intercollegiate athletics and recreation at New York Institute of Technology.
New York Tech.
And he is a graduate of NYIT and was a member of the men's basketball team that participated in the D2 National Championship in 1980. In addition, he oversees all recreation intramural activities at the university. And I understand that he just came back from a, well, I guess it wasn't a secret meeting, but I'm sure everything to talk about it, they want to keep secret. I'm in California about maybe giving a few pennies, a few crumbs to the collegiate ball players at the university.
So you mean the athletes who actually raise and make all the money?
The athletes that make the for hundreds of millions of dollars for these. And, you know, for all these years, I thought it was the NCAA that were the criminals. It's not. These daggone presidents, they are running a, it's got to be a criminal enterprise at their colleges.
So you're saying they're just, like, milking the public, not
yeah,
giving any
I
money
mean,
to the players, keeping it for their
Hyman Roth would be proud of these guys.
Chris Christie.
Right?
Yes, now, sir.
Think about these college presidents.
Will be nice. Shenanigans.
And the shenanigans that went on out in, I believe, in San Francisco?
Well, you know, I wouldn't call it shenanigans. It was in San Diego. We had our national convention, and it's where Division I, II, and III comes together. And mostly Division I doesn't meet together because they changed their governance structure a long time ago, but they're trying to get it back because they have found out over the years that it's just not a very equal and democratic way to run an organization. And I think a lot of the fallout is what you're talking about, how things are run and oversee and where the distribution of money is going to. And, you know, you mentioned this whole process about paying players, and there's a trickle-down effect, and everybody is now rushing in to make judgment about what to do, but it is basically controlled by presidents or universities that make a lot of money. Now, you look at all the money that's being made, it's only being made by a certain small percentages of school that have the wealth. And you talk about the top five conferences, those big five they call it now, they're the ones who's calling the shots in all of this, and football rules the roost. So they're the ones in charge of how these monies are distributed. And it's not the NCAA. I'm part of the NCAA on the Division II level, and, you know, we're nowhere close to being an expert in those fields, but we are able to exist because of the Division I basketball contract, Division II and III. We get parts of that money to exist, and our budgets and our development for our student athletes all come out of there. Now, the revenue sharing comes largely out of football, and that's only controlled by five
companies. Well, listen, aren't we talking about a criminal enterprise? I mean, come on, you're talking about five major colleges get
conferences.
Five conferences that get a bulk of the money. I mean, this is the same way the mafia operates. Come on.
Well, you know, I mean, you could dice it and slice it, Mike, any way you want, and, you know, you can call it a tomato or a tomato, but, you know, that's what it is. That's why there was a big argument about getting away from these bowl games, because they were in control of how the money was distributed and who was distributed to what conferences, and no one wanted to let go of that funding. And that's why every other division in the NCAA has a playoff system except Division I, BCS football, which is BCS is gone, but that whole level never had a conference playoff. And they try to give you arguments about class time and everything, which is a lot of baloney, because the rest of the football playing schools in the FCS have a playoff. Division II has a playoff division, and they're no different athletes. They might not be the same caliber as the top echelons, but they're still athletes, and they all have playoffs. So it's about the money. It's basically about the money, and now you're having pushback because you're paying coaches millions, $5 million, $3 million, and now you've got an assistant coaches who are making millions, $2 million. This is craziness.
Well, there's a lot of money left over because Joe Paterno is dead. So I'm sure it's on that money out someplace else. Because,
yeah.
I mean, after all,
let's say in defense that perhaps the idea was supposed to be like the Olympic Games, that mm-hmm. they tainted with pain that they would play for the glory of play, just for sports itself, right? So see,
right.
That's the that you don't want to taint the players or something. But it's just it's crap.
Were you bored yesterday?
Well, it's got out of control because now you got big business television, the media is involved with it, and then you know ESPN has their hand in all this also too, and the CBS and whoever else televises these games, having schools play on a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, where football was a Saturday only type of environment. If you look at the schedule and what they dictate to individuals is crazy. Even in basketball, when they have start times of 1, 2 o'clock in the morning and these people are out there playing basketball, where is the student athlete quality of life and welfare comes into play? It doesn't. It goes out the window when the dollar steps in.
Well, you know, and a big gap. I need to ask you, bring you in here because I have been using the Michael Corleone franchise, Hyman Roth entity but realistically, wasn't the whole thing? Can you imagine where Hyman Roth, if he was alive right now, with all this pay going to these from these networks? And to these presidents, where he would be with this?
Well, again, you know, as Clyde was pointing out, the major conferences, there's five major conferences and the big schools, they're in a whole different world. You know what I'm saying? It's like a guy's coaching, volunteering to coach a little league team or a junior high school team. That's the purity of sport that Tom was relating to, with the Olympic ideal and all this. But when you start getting up here to the University of Alabama and Texas and Notre Dame and Penn State, the millions of dollars drives the force. And like Clyde said, the schedule of games tells you something's wrong. These teams are traveling all across the country. These are supposed to be student athletes. When could they possibly be in class if Arkansas is flying to New York to play the University of California in New York at Holiday Festival or something like that? You know, these planes don't get out there in 1 hour, play the game, and get them back home in 1 hour. It's money. But don't mistake, and I think Clyde was trying to point this out too a little bit, don't mistake the fact of the schools that make that gigantic money with the other schools that are really more grounded and you know, they have to, because of their budgets, they have to be more realistic. They can't send their students off on a trip across the country. So Hofstra's playing against LIU, things like that. Local schools are playing other local schools. It's not like this Texas schedule and this UCA schedule. And, you know, there's a whole different class structure. That's the that's what he's pointing out, I think, that those big five conferences with their budget and stuff is just a whole – they're superpowers.
Well, you know
– and, you know
– yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, though, that, I mean, today's athlete that plays football, he needs a passport because he don't know when he's going to go overseas to play a game. So the thing is that now we have as soon as the first person started walking through that turnstile and buying all that popcorn and beer, they said, oh, let's build a bigger stadium. And then let's build another stadium.
Well, Michael, you're right. It's
an
opportunity. It's an opportunity that spoke sore. It's starting off, as the gentleman said earlier, as something purist on Olympic, amateurism, this is what we do, athletes, it supports the school, it brands the school, and it turned out to be or evolving into this big money operation. And as George pointed out, those big five schools control things. And, you know, you guys talk about the impact on student-athlete welfare. Football doesn't have the same impact that it has on the other sports. Football flies out on a Friday maybe. They play on a Saturday. They come back on a Saturday night. You know, you're not going to miss a lot of class time. But being in a conference that flies you all over the place, your volleyball team, your basketball team, your baseball team, those are the students that suffer. But they can't say much because football is the one paying the freights. So they suffer academically. So it's a trickle-down effect, and from an academic perspective with those big schools, which I hear about it. SMU being in a conference over in here in the Northeast, does that make any sense from a geographical standpoint? No, but the dollars make sense. Why did Maryland have to get out of the ACC, a tremendous conference that they were founding members, to go into the Big Ten because of money? And they couldn't have sustain their budgets in the ACC? That is almost laughable and ludicrous.
Well, you know, but the thing is now, all right, so you know, you just mentioned that they couldn't maintain their budget. Is this a push of the alumni and the boosters and the presidents of that university to get into the
Well, I think the presidents are being held hostage by alumni and boosters. Everybody wants to win. Nobody wants to come in second place. Nobody wants to play fair. If their school is not winning, then something's wrong. Somebody's getting fired. And then they're firing people at cost to the university because they're still retaining these contracts and have to pay these people out. So no one wants to say, oh, it was good competition, it's good fair, out of the Big Five. They all need to win. They all want the money to stay right with them. The rest of the NCAA, which is a lot of schools, don't have the same attitude. But we're held hostage because every time someone says the NCAA, they all think we're all in this together.
Right.
Well, and we are to a certain perspective, but then again, we're not from a financial perspective.
Well, but see, are they I don't have this idea in my mind that this was all about the good. It ain't never been about the good. It's been about money, period.
Well, yeah. It's where you place money at. Is money a good thing?
Absolutely.
And for whom?
That's right. I mean, they just fired. I think we were talking about this last night. Who's the coach that just got fired? He was making $5 million. Now he's over there in, Arkansas?
Arkansas. Yeah, he left Wisconsin at about $3 million to go to Arkansas, like $5 million. And look at the guy who left Arkansas and got fired. He's right back at Louisville, and he's going to probably make $3 or $4 million.
Right. So, I mean, you got these coaches who only play a handful of games a year, making more money
than the president. They're probably the whole staff, the whole faculty, and have less duties within the university than anybody else does as well.
Wait, they set the duties for everybody else. I mean, Joe Paterno, the only thing that Joe Paterno was the governor of the state.
He was a very busy man with all the children.
Yeah, I know. But,
but things have become even more egregious in modern times, besides just the whole, you know, stadium ticket sales or any of that type of stuff, is that now I dare you to go anywhere. You know, find any shop. There's online stores and in your local Kmart, Walmart, Target, everywhere else. You can't go in and not be hit by an entire flood of products from your local school.
Mm-hmm.
It's become massive. I'm talking about they got Gizmo and hat and shirt, and they got kids ones and pregnant lady ones and, you know, grandma ones. It's insane. But that's big.
It's
money, right?
It's the marketing penetration and the licensing, and it's all, you're right, absolutely right. It's big money, and they are continuing to roll, and they're not going to let it stop until someone stops them or the bottom falls out. And it's the public. It's the public's overwhelming attraction to sports. No matter what happens in sports, we put athletes up on a pedestal, and for some reason we will do anything we have to do to watch them and cater to them. And they know that right now, and it's a very psychological impact or effect that it has, sports has.
Well, George, isn't this just like the narcotics coming in from Mexico or wherever? You know, hey, ain't our fault you guys want the dope, stop taking drugs.
Yeah, it's like
I mean, you got a market here, and the market don't want to stop. They don't want a little bit. They want more and more every day. So how do you go about – you got an example right here. Scholarships in college sports are a scarce resource. The FBC – the FBS college football, for example, 85 players are allowed to receive scholarship money per team. But a team that has a roster of 120 – players, the other 45 get jacked.
Yeah.
Now, what the hell is this when the daggone college professor is making $20 million or $30 million a year? I mean, come on, and he don't do jack.
Mike, just a correction on that. That doesn't mean that 85 student-athletes are getting full scholarships. They can get partials also, too, because that money can be distributed over 120 people also, too. So just don't think that 85 are getting scholarship. And then there's also a combination of academic money and things that you package your student-athletes to try to stretch it. Now, there probably are some, your key people, who are getting full scholarships. There's no question about that. But then there's other money. That money is distributed in a very calculated manner.
Okay, so you're saying that all 120 people?
You could possibly. You could give everybody a dollar and say they're on athletic scholarships, Mike.
Well,
I mean, it's any way you can. It's
not
any
a
way
full
you look
ride.
At it. It's not a full.
It's
you don't have to give
ride.
A full ride to say it's an athletic scholarship. We give out partials here because that's how we manage it, because we don't have that kind of budget. And if you you know, the maximums allow you to give out 85 in football and at FCS, that means you got 85 full scholarships that you can distribute to as many folks as you want, but you can't go over that $85 amount.
Right. Well, but this is what I'm saying. You got a bank president, a bank president,
yeah, yeah,
the president of the university getting $20 million, and then you're telling me an athlete comes in there and his first game that he plays in football breaks his leg and never play another game, does his scholarship go down the tubes?
No. I only can speak for myself, and that's autonomy. If something happens like that here, that individual would keep their scholarship as long as they academically do what they have to do during their 4 years of school here. Most schools, I would say, would honor those. A lot of big schools, it's such a flesh market. They need the bodies. They do a lot of things that you have seen happen already where they get rid of people. And I'm sorry to say that's the meat market of the whole sport, especially with football.
Right.
But you're allowed to honor that scholarship. And, you know, most credible schools will do the right thing.
Well, coming at it from a financial point of view,
right,
this is one of the problems that I've seen. No matter what you feel is right or should happen, the schools play, you know, financial games. And they are very good at shuffling the money around however you want to say it, cooking the books or whatever, to make it look like no one ever makes money at athletic program. But there is no money. And they're just scraping by. But that's BS, and you know it. So how do you get transparency and actual accountability into the accounting so that you can actually, you know, do something productive with the money?
Well, that's what a lot of folks are talking about, and maybe it takes someone outside of even the NCAA to come in and start looking at just what you spoke about, you know, the transparency. Where is this money going? Is it going back into the institution? Is it serving other students within the institution? How is it managed? What does it look like? And is it real? So that's why and the NCAA is very fearful of the federal government coming in and doing just that. So there is a lot of discussion about that very topic.
Well, okay. Now,
so that would get into that anti-racketeering.
Right.
Well,
this is a racketeering enterprise here. College sport industry generates approximately $11 billion in annual revenue. 50 colleges report annual revenues that exceed $50 million. Meanwhile, 5 collegiates report annual revenues that exceed $100 million. These revenues come from numerous sources, including ticket sales, sponsorships rights, and the sale of broadcast rights. You think? So the thing is that when you're selling broadcast rights and just say basketball, they're saying here it's upwards of $770 million per season, and the Big Ten Conference has launched its own television network. So now they keep all the money.
So the University of Texas, it by itself, has its own television network. They don't even need the conference anymore. But, Mike, how many schools did you just mention with those figures? Was 55 you mentioned with those type of figures? You
50,
know,
50 colleges.
50 colleges.
Yeah, exceed $50 million. And
okay. And
five report over $100 million.
Okay, so that's 55 colleges you mentioned. In all of the college playing college athletics, that is less than 1%. So it goes to show you where the money is being kept, and it's not shared amongst all the rest of us who are participating in athletics. So you're talking about a small segment of people who have the power and is not relinquishing that financial power. And they don't want to.
That's right. And this is, George, I want you to get it here. Isn't this one of the reasons why they have revenue sharing in baseball? Because they need to keep these other teams, and basketball, they need to keep these other teams and, well, teams in basketball, schools, it behooves them to keep these other teams involved.
Well, you know, the thing about the talent pool, I mean, what I'm looking at is the talent pool. When you talk about these first-round draft choices in football, basketball, baseball, anything, these kids can't go to the smaller schools. They have to go because the big schools scout them out, romance them starting in junior high school. They rate junior high school players now. You know, they rate junior high school players. They tell you a guy is in the seventh grade, but he's 6'1" already and so-and-so, and he plays for this coach, and they scout him, and they know where he's going to play, and in the summertime where he plays. You know, and those are the big schools to do that.
They were doing that to you when you were in the middle school. So, I mean, that's something you should know about. They were scouting you. So,
I don't know about that with me, but they it's amazing. I'm telling you, when that the books are kept on these kids, records are kept on kids, and especially if they are tall in basketball or powerful in football, you know, and they're going to end up at the big schools. But every school, you know, we're saying colleges, but I think Clyde is trying to also point out that your local schools that have athletics, they're not in this picture with these Texas and Arkansas and Notre Dame's and stuff. That's a whole different world. It's like you doing neighborhood theater production. You putting on your little neighborhood theater show. That's not comparing to Hollywood
or Broadway
or the Broadway stage. You know, it's a whole different class structure, and that's what Clyde I think has mentioned a couple
exactly.
of times that
exactly.
they're not sharing that money.
No.
With anybody. They have it, like you said, Texas has their own network. Notre Dame can dictate their schedule because they're popular all over the country. They can dictate who they want to play against and stuff like that. You know, the other thing is they have a Clyde, I forgot what they call the game, but when the little schools get a game, most little schools get a game against a big school.
The guarantee.
Like you play, I remember CW Post played
Syracuse.
The guy, their budget, they said they made almost half their budget from that one game.
Yeah, because they got a guarantee to go up there and play and
right.
lose.
They
but
know
they're
going to
lose. But they generated funds for their department.
Right. They know they're going to lose, but it's like the first game of the season, and the school wants to make their rookie players sound good or look good. So they go out and play a school that they know they have outclassed. You know, they can't possibly lose. And they win the game by 50 points.
Well, we relaxed the rules with that, George. We relaxed the rules with that, George, to allow that to happen where a Division II school can play against a Division I school and have that type of environment and exposure, because the rules prior to a couple of years ago didn't allow you to play up and it would hurt your whole scheduling and RPI and the rest of the stuff. And to go to another point you made, George, the smaller schools like a Wilmington, UCL Wilmington, or even the one in Charlotte, when they get into the tournament, they do well. Everybody's always rooting for the Cinderella schools because they don't have that type of exposure that these big five conference schools have, and that's why everybody's so excited about their success.
Well, you know, in 2011, I just listened to this, 2011, the NCAA members paid their association president, Mark Emmett, $1.7 million.
Yep.
Head football coaches at the 44 NCAA Bowl Championship Series schools received an average of $2.1 million in salary. The highest paid public employee in 40 of the 50 U.S. states is the state university's head president or basketball coach. At the University of Alabama, head football coach, as we talked about, Nick Saban, received a contract that pays him $7 million a year, more than 160 times the average wage of the Taruska public school system teacher.
But they will tell you, Mike, that is a good they'll tell you that's a good ROI because of what he has done for the university and how much money that football program is bringing in. It's not education anymore. It's big business. Bottom line, you know, I always tell people, if you look at – take Michigan, for instance. You take a pro entity, a basketball team, a Knicks has an arena. That's $20,000 at the Knicks. There's $20,000 over at the Nets. You take University of Michigan. Well, they have a 20,000-seat arena for basketball. They have a 120,000-seat football stadium, which exceeds all football stadiums in the pro circuit. They got a hockey arena that's $15,000. They're running pro sports in each sport at one locale. So you can imagine the enterprise that is going on there. It far exceeds the educational piece.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So now we have players that come to college and they are not learning what they wanted to go to school for, because they're going to school for basketball or football. But they need to have graduated with a degree, but they are not working at the ice cream and ball shop like it was shown in all the movies in the 1940s and 50s. They're not working at the local Macy's. They're working every day, probably 3 to 4 hours or 5 hours a day, on their dribble and their jump shot. That is their job. That is their job, and they're bringing and catching touchdowns and throwing touchdowns. So they are bringing the revenue into the school. So this is the reason why, and they're getting very little back. They're getting nothing back. And this is their ergo, the $2,000, which we're going to get to in a minute, that they're considering giving these ball players. Well, this is the criminal enterprise that Tony Soprano ran in Jersey. He had his people out there making, picking up the drops and picking all the money.
Well, Mike, and I think that's the point that everyone's trying to raise, is the ethics that goes along with it. And I think that the rules which are made by the association to try to protect smaller schools against the big schools, because if they loosen these rules at times, the bigger schools will be able to run wild and afford things that these smaller schools can't. But in the same breath, there's a shortcoming with being able to take care of athletes in a better fashion with resources that they have made over a period of time, and I think this point is coming to that. Now, I'm not for paying any student-athletes because I think they're already getting paid through scholarships and things like that, but I am in favor of increasing what we do with their scholarships to allow them to have a better way of life during their college time, especially those schools that are making that kind of money. I think everything is relative.
Better way of life, what does that mean?
Well, some of these, like you said, they can't work, Mike, and they're on the field all day long. So if you just getting a meal 3 days a day and the cafeteria closes and I can't get a job and I need extra money because I'm 300 pounds and I need to eat, how am I going to eat? How am I going to wash my clothes? And your scholarship doesn't account for all of that, and I can't get a job because I'm getting a full scholarship, so I'm not supposed to work. Something is wrong with that model.
Absolutely.
So
to make their
lives better, there should be funding or allocations or a way they can do something legitimately within the rules to support themselves a little better. They can't. Some of them come from very tough backgrounds, and they don't have money from homes that some folks can send their kids dollars and cents and packages and resources. So where is that coming from? I mean, I'm sitting there all by myself, and next thing you know, I'm in trouble. I'm doing something I'm not supposed to be doing.
Right.
And when the
Absolutely.
School, well, it's one thing if the schools didn't have it, like a Hofstra or something where we're very tight with money, or NYIT, but when you have a school paying your coach, like you just said, $7 million, and they're building new parts of the stadiums, and they're giving this one of since they coach a million dollars, what about the young men and women who are generating this funds? Make their scholarships more meaningful.
Right. And that would also, that's one of the reasons that it feeds into the corruption charges when you in a way are trying to help out these athletes, but also you're kind of bidding on them. But that's when schools get into trouble by, you know, paying the kids rent or giving them a car.
Well,
or whatever.
Rent,
they do that. You know, they get in trouble all the time for that. But that's part of the problem is because they're not paid.
Right.
So they're having to do things like this, like, hey, I can't get by, or my mom can't get by. Can you help me out?
Right.
And so when they give them a little something to help them out, then it's illegal. And
now I know George. See, you had one of those super duper scholarships when you were at St. Francis, so you didn't need anything. You didn't have to work. But,
back in those days, you were just grateful. I mean, I was grateful the fact that my books were paid for. I didn't have to. I went to the bookstore, and I just ordered the books I needed, and they gave them to me. We got jackets, school jackets, blazers, and things like that. Didn't pay for them. So I mean, but those were, those things were within the legal limits like that. But they made
things
a difference. You are treated better. But again, you're giving up that time too. When you could be going home, you're in the gym. So it's a trade off. But it was reasonable. But here's something that struck me. I was at the Garden once, and they said that Oscar Robertson and his Cincinnati Bearcats are coming into the Garden to play. And I said, there's something strange, and I couldn't figure out what it was until I was going home on the subway. They call the name of the player before they call the school. I never heard that before. You know what I'm saying? You say Boys High is coming in with Connie Hawkins or something like that, or the Atlanta Braves are coming in with Hank Aaron. You don't say in the amateur sports, you don't announce the name of a player at a school, a student, headlining the team. Like, let's say Johnny Manziel and his Texas A&M football team. You're selling the player. When you say the player's name ahead of the school, there's something that's so commercial about that. It's something that's different than just saying, the team and then the player's name. That's a professional thing. You say Babe Ruth is coming in with his New York Yankees. You don't say, you don't say some kid's name and then say at his school.
Well, that's
the
whole marketing
piece,
Joe. It's
the
commercial
power.
It's the marketing commercial piece, George.
Yeah. Right.
You don't say Yankees and Babe Ruth. You say Babe Ruth and the New York Yankees.
Yeah. But see, that's getting that. Everything is commercialized these days because now they don't play at Dodger Stadium. Right? It's always, Target Superstore at AT&T Park.
Right.
MetLife Stadium.
Right.
Yeah. And that goes back to what you were saying about the deceit and the recruiting problems that they have because they're recruiting these kids or young men and women or mostly men who are branded even coming out of high school or junior high school. Like George was talking about how early they're going after these young people. And now you got ESPN. ESPN is televising high school sports. Come on. Give me a break. When would we do in high school sports on a national level? Putting their games on, having all-star games. So these young men have names already, and they know that they're marketable. So that's what's drawing the dollars towards these schools because now everybody wants to be with them.
Oh, yeah, and the thing is now, you got
these. Michael, we're bigger than U.S. Steel.
And this is the thing. They're bigger than U.S. Steel.
Michael.
And that's the problem.
Yes, Michael, you're bigger than U.S. Steel.
Yes, Mike.
That's right. So this is the thing. When these colleges are selling this amateur quarterback or tight end or running back to sell more tickets.
You're exactly right. It's big business, exactly. This market is supply and demand, and that's why they all go and get these young men. Look at Kentucky. How many guys have come there in the basketball team, played 1 year, and they're gone? They don't even care about it. They don't care about the education. They just play 1 year. They know they're going to go to pro. Five of them get drafted, and they're gone. Where's the educational piece in that? It's all about those names.
Absolutely.
Well, that's right. Like they had that guy. It was about a year and a half ago. I can't remember the guy's name, but one of the athletes, he's got – something they got on TV by doing something with, like, one of the celebrity times, crap. And they were asking him why, and he said, it's all about building my brand.
He wanted to get on TV. He knew exactly.
Yeah, they don't care about anything else, but you got to build that name.
I find the NBA at fault here in the court systems because a lot of these young men don't want to go to school. Why force them to go to school for a year and make a mockery of the educational system? It's a junior league. to so they can brand themselves like you guys just said, so they can promote themselves to get into the NBA. Let them go play someplace else where you're not making a mockery of the college system, and give a scholarship to young men and women who want to be there for 4 years and get a degree. Because right. that scholarship is a means to an end.
Right.
Well, you know, there's a lot of small schools, especially in football, where, you know, they weren't the big school, they weren't on TV, they weren't, but you have a lot of good football players that have come out of small-time colleges
yep.
and are the Hall of Fame. So where is that? That scenario lie in all this.
Yeah, but those are natural athletes.
Yeah.
Well, those are athletes who stayed in school for 4 years, built their craft, stayed determined, and made the most out of their opportunity. And you know what? Across the board, athletics is getting better. Even at Division II schools, Division III schools, the facilities are getting better. The competition is getting better. Everybody's putting more money into it. And you got more people playing and participating in sports across the board. So the competition levels are better. So there are good athletes out of there. And I'm quite sure there's a lot of athletes who just – for whatever reason, could play in the NBA, who could play in the NFL, but there's not enough room for them to play there. So they try to do other things overseas, Canada, wherever they can get an opportunity, but it's just not enough places. You know, the roster on a football team, a pro team, is only 53 people.
Well, you know, listen, George and I talk about this all the time. I mean, I remember growing up, Major League Baseball, if you didn't see 14 missed bounces on a grounder in the infield in a game, you must have been looking or in the bathroom. Because, and today, there ain't a missed bounce unless it hits a seam, and those are no longer anymore. We're talking about baseball now in the infield. So mm-hmm. you got guys who are getting paid. Hey, let's talk about the man from the Yankees, $245 million for a second baseman, Cano. Are you kidding me? That's complete nonsense for a second baseman to get $25 million. I mean, when you have second baseman who are outrageous, Jackie Robinson. I mean, we're talking about infielders, Ernie Banks, great hitters and infielders. So you're talking about branding now. I don't blame the Yankees not giving this man, you know, $245 million. But my grandfather used to say every time the guy made an error on the infield or in the outfield, he said he needs to pay his way to get in the ballpark the next day. So, but the thing is that we are, it's because the money is there to pay them. Because people, as you said, Clyde, will pay to watch a candle burn.
There's no question about it. And especially, Mike, if you put it on one thing, if you put anything on television, look what he's done to environment, these stupid videos and everything. That these, anything you pull your pants down, you put on a video, I want to pull my pants down. I want to pull a do-rag over my head. You put it on TV, I want to pull a do-rag over my head. So it's all about the media. And whatever these guys want to put on television, well, look at the biggest thing on television, reality shows. That's the biggest crap in the world.
Dynasty. I mean, what are you kidding me?
You know, what happened to good television? Look at George. He's a movie critic. Half of the stuff on television he probably doesn't even watch because it's garbage. But if it's on television, the kids, that's what they feel that they need to emulate. And that's the sad thing. The TV controls. ESPN controls. I can't stand ESPN.
Yeah. Hey, look, that's what I've been telling Mike for years. But, you know, I come from an educational and literary background. I was like, you know, athletics, man, if you gave me 20 hot girls in little bitty bikinis dancing in front of a library and librarians that were bashing each other, tackling each other, trying to get the book for the student, I bet you I could turn it into a multimillion-dollar sports franchise.
You damn Skippy.
Well, the thing is, but you see, there's one thing that hasn't happened. We don't see all these people trying to emulate going out and being vampires and werewolves. Because
not
that's what
well, none that you know of right now, though.
So, all right. Well, tell us a little bit about something, what they talked about out there in that meeting in San Diego, beautiful San Diego.
Well, you know, I mean, Division II, we have a different philosophy of life and the balance, and we do a lot of different things. So on a Division II level, we are doing a lot of great things to support the student-athlete welfare and branding athletics in the right way. On a Division I level, they have their work cut out for them. They came together for the first time, and there was a lot of discussion about the things that we just spoke about, looking at their governance structure and saying, this is not right. We have to make changes. So there's a lot of changes being talked about, and especially aimed at the Big Five, how they're going to handle things, how it's going to impact the rest of the schools, because even if the Big Five, they can't just play against themselves. They got to play against somebody else outside of those conferences. And those other schools are going to have a voice in what goes on and how this money is distributed. So I guess over the next 2 years, a year, you're going to see some changes, some discussion, and it's going to be ongoing.
Well, yeah, see, you mentioned before that you didn't like paying the athletes, and I say, yeah, you're right at that, but I want them to get paid another way. I'd like to have each one of these athletes have an account that they can draw from. They have to submit a chit to the daggone registrar, whoever it is, say they got $5,000 in the account for the entire year, not semester, year. And they can draw on it for incidentals like toothpaste and fixing their car because the car just got in an accident, they probably get the dental paid for. But things like that, washing your clothes, normal things that normal kids need. I mean, what do you think about that? Have it in an account. And they got to submit a chit. I'm writing it because I got to get this. And they got to bring back the receipt and give it to them.
That's all got to be planned out and organized and see how it is. And then, Mike, who do you pay and who don't you pay? Who gets the $5,000? Who doesn't get the $5,000?
Every ball player that's on every single team needs to have something in there because he's there or she.
Talking about football and basketball? What about tennis, lacrosse, soccer, men's soccer, swimming, badminton, golf?
If you got a scholarship to go to this school. Okay, definitely. Now, if you made the team, I think you need to have that if you are a member of the team. Because the member who's on the who's the sixth man or the seventh man on a basketball team, he's just as every part of that team as the starters.
Yeah,
I mean,
certain schools that can afford that. What about Hofstra, like George said? They couldn't afford to do that.
That's all right. That's why they need revenue sharing.
That's not going to happen. Would LIU revenue share with Yale or Princeton revenue share with the schools in Ivy League or schools that are non-Ivy League? That's not going to happen.
Of course, you listen. But they had to do it in pro sports.
Well, pro sports are different. You buy into pro sports. No one's buying into conglomerate for colleges. They're independent.
Yeah, come on. They're buying into it. Every time you go out and buy a daggone orange scarf for Syracuse, you bought into the daggone school.
Yeah, you're buying into it on an independent basis. I mean, the pros got together and they put together and they got this pot and they got these governors and board of directors. The NCAA tries to regulate it from a rule perspective, but from the financial perspective, I don't know how that's – it's not in my lifetime. I'll be out of the system before that happens.
Oh, you might be, but this is a criminal enterprise.
Yeah.
It's a criminal enterprise. I heard it.
Mike,
needs to be done.
You answered. You said all that needed to be said earlier.
Right.
An $11 billion.
Yeah, right.
$11 billion.
Yeah.
That answers everything.
You're talking about $3,000 or $4,000 in a kitty for a daggone a student to pay for some toothpaste for some underwear and socks? Come on. What are we talking about?
How about get a percentage of the entire school program?
No, like, that's not. That,
you
they
plan
all
to get 1%
suicide.
Or whatever.
Yeah, right. No. I think that you're right. You could be out of the whole collegiate scenario, but it was a hell of a long time it took them to get that in baseball and football.
Mike, I don't disagree with that. Something has to be done to support student athletes in a better fashion from financial perspective. How that's going to be obtained and reached is the discussion that's on the table, and I think people have to come to the table honest and able to speak and open up their books and speak to the point of helping everybody, which people don't want to do, not just in athletics but across the board. So it's going to be an interesting debate and ongoing. And the athletes, even with this case that the O'Bannon has raised, the former UCLA player against the UCLA about the antitrust thing is still ongoing, and it's going to be interesting to see how the courts unravel that.
What is that saying? It's a criminal enterprise. Here you got students who are in there who are breaking their butts every day, and they can't be about getting $3,000 when there's $11 billion floating around? I mean, what are we talking about here? Listen, you got to remember now, these daggone colleges raise their damn tuition every year.
Yeah, and that's another point that I was just thinking as you was talking. You got to take in consideration the student that doesn't get any money, who's paying $45,000 a year to support their college education and not getting any scholarship dollars. How does that impact them? And they still have to go out and work and do all these other things. So there's a lot of things that these colleges need to do before we outprice ourselves into a market that it blows up. And I think it's heading that direction. I think it's about there's an implosion about to happen.
Yeah, these colleges, and they can't give rhyme or reason why they're raising tuition 10% or 15%, and they're building another science lab, $199 million. Are you kidding me?
You're right. I mean, it has to be rethought, and you know, and then you look at the salaries that these people are making. Presidents are making a lot of money also too, like you said earlier when you started this whole thing, millions of dollars. And at whose expense? Not only are they making millions of dollars, that's just the salary. You're talking about compensation packages. They don't pay for anything. They don't pay to eat. They don't pay to transportation. They don't pay to live. So their packages are upward, and then who pays that freight? And every year, 20%, 5%, 10%, the tuition rates are going up, room and board is going up. It's about to implode.
Well, we were talked about this before yesterday, I believe. The Joe Paterno, you got to remember that the governor of the state of North Carolina was the DA in the same case in outside the school in the same town. What's the town? Princeton, yeah. Okay. He was the DA there when the first rape case was brought about. He was the one that got that thrown under the bus. And look where he landed, in the governor's mansion. How did that happen? Because Joe Paterno wanted it to happen. Joe Paterno was the godfather in Pennsylvania. Nothing went on there. I mean, without that school, Princeton, there was nothing.
Penn State.
Yeah, Penn State. You saying Princeton. Penn State. If Penn State would have closed up, the town would have closed up.
Mike, you have very strong opinions about what you don't even know what you're talking about.
Yes.
You have a damn strong opinion. I like it.
But the thing is this is the case. And these athletic directors and they run the school. It's not even the presidents or the boards anymore.
Well, it's all money. All money.
So what I'd like to find out is what I'd like to find out from you, Clive, is what was the result that you came away with?
Well, like I said, there really was no hard result, except that I think for the last 5 years, there was no discussion, no coming to the table of the Division I governance or powership of the those in power. They're coming together and talking about it because they see what's going on out here in the environment, and they're opening up the discussion. So I think moving forward, Mike, you're going to see some changes and how they look at these scholarships, how they look at this money. Maybe they're coming into a revenue situation. Maybe the distribution is going to be different. But they know things have got to change. And they know they can't keep paying these people this kind of money without supporting student-athletes in a better way, because it's going to blow up on them. And I think the next step, and if they don't do it, someone's going to step in and do it for them, and Big Brother's watching them. The federal government is watching them. Not to say that they're not Ivan Lansky them damn selves either, but they're going to come in and look at what's going on and say, look, you got to make changes within your paradigms to support these student-athletes or these students in a better fashion. So that's what I think is coming out of that discussion. And it was good to see them come together because they never come to the convention anymore. It's all by rule by a group of people, the governor's structure, the president. But now they're saying we have to get – Division I doesn't even vote anymore. We in Division II and III have one membership, one vote. They didn't even vote on issues anymore. Somebody sets the program, and they have to go along with it. Well, I think they're trying to get away from that.
Well, listen, as I said it 101 times already during this conversation, it's a criminal enterprise, and the government was going to step in into baseball if they didn't change their end of it, and they changed their end of it. Because the hammer was coming down on them.
And so, you're right about that. Yep, I agree with it. And that's just what I feel is going to happen. If we don't change, and I'm talking about we because I'm part of the NCAA, if we and my big brothers don't change, someone's going to come in and change for them because you got to manage change or change is going to manage you.
Well, now since
Let's hear you're part of it. Where's can you give me a million? I'm just a million short.
That's all you need?
That'll
do me. I mean, you know.
See, right away, he didn't say a million. He said, is that all you need?
Is that all?
let me tell you a story, and I'm not going to tell you what school it is, but I have a friend who works at one of these big – he works in a school that's in one of the big five conferences, and his athletic director was sitting there, and somebody else outside of the school was bugging him about something. They came in. He wrote them, somebody else in the school, a check for $1 million and said, okay, will this take care of whatever you need? And they said, thank you very much, and left.
Oh, Lord. God.
And that's a true story.
That's all you need to know, right?
That's it. Criminal enterprise. I mean,
when I was teaching in the summertime, this is George, when I was teaching in the summertime at Princeton in a athletic program for Nike, they took us on a tour of the Princeton University campus. And the girl who was leading the tour said to us, she was showing us a portrait of somebody, and she says, somebody famous. And then she said, the endowment here, the money that we have in the bank account that – from gifts and things like that, was $16 billion. This was 25 years ago. I raised my hand. I said, excuse me, did you say $1 billion? She said, yes. They had 16, this is 25 years ago, $16 billion in money that's just sitting there, gifts, that in an endowment. $16 billion, 25 years ago. And she also explained this. She said, we were having a fundraiser to build a new swimming pool or improve the swimming pool. And she said that a guy came up to her at the affair to raise money for the swimming pool. And he said, what is all this about? Why am I – he was an alumni. He said, what is this all about? Because I don't like to come to these things. She said, we're trying to raise $250,000 or something like that to improve the swimming pool or something. He says, well, I don't want to come to any more of these things. I'll write you a check for that $250,000.
Mm-hmm.
This was they had three fundraisers planned. This guy said, I'll give you the money now. You know what they told him? They said, you can't give us $250,000. You have to give us a half a million. Because they said, no, because here's what they said. The girl explained it. She says, people – like at the Ivy League schools and stuff like that and other schools, they said they want to give us stuff. Their families will want to give us their jewel collection. They want to give us a Matisse or a Picasso. They said, we have to take care of that. You can't take a Picasso and just stick it up on a wall and say it's a Picasso. You've got to get a humidity-controlled frame. You've got to have a security guard there and everything like that. She said, you have to pay for the expense of the gift for 3 years. So this guy, she told the guy, if you pay for the pool, you'd have to pay for the improvements to the pool. You'd also have to pay for the salary of the lifeguard, the salary of the maintenance for 3 years. So she said it would be double. And, she didn't say what he did after that. But the idea is they said people always want to give us stuff. We're dealing with the most elite people. They have money. They want to give us stuff, but then we'd be stuck with having to take care of it. We can't take your jewel collection and just stick it in a glass and say, here it is. You got to have guards and got to have alarm systems. So you have to pay for all the maintenance for that for 3 years. After 3 years, we'll figure out a way to get some money out of what you gave us or whatever. So, but, I mean, $16 billion was the money that they had laying around. So, I mean, it's frightening to say, you know, when Clyde is pointing out this about this power of the certain schools, this was Princeton University and had $16 billion sitting around in the endowment. It's not money that they need to feed themselves. This is money that's sitting in the bank.
Well, $16 billion. You also say the reason why that they you couldn't do that is because that half that money was Mr. Paterno's. She didn't say that.
Yeah. Don't get your Princeton mixed up with your Penn State again. But anyway,
I'm getting Princeton. Well, it's one of them.
Yeah,
I have to give it a peek. Anyway.
But like Clyde keeps pointing out, it's a complicated problem because there's so many you're stepping on so many people's toes and everything like that. If you do this and do that, and you know, athletes are athletes. You know, you're penalizing somebody when you have just football, basketball, and baseball, or football and basketball, because I mean, the guy on the fencing team is an athlete, the guy on the soccer team is an athlete,
correct?
The people on the polo team, not the polo team, the volleyball team are athletes.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? It's so you got a whole thing there where we don't really we're talking football and basketball because they're the revenue sports. So when you say athletes and like you say, like distribute this money, well now you're discriminating against the guy that's playing volleyball. He's an athlete.
Yeah, but
girls sports. Female sports,
and that's a good point, George, because you got gender equity things on a federal level that you have to deal with also
too,
taking the task on paying coaches more in a men's basketball coach than a women's basketball coach, resources, building a facilities for men, and not doing the same thing for women. So there's a whole nother piece that goes into this whole decision making.
Right.
You can't build a football stadium for women. They use the same. They're not playing.
Well, but they do use the fields. They use fields for field hockey and women's soccer and everything else. So, yeah, there's nothing that equates to football. And they already know that. That's what drives gender equity numbers crazy. But the things that you can't build a special padded, heated, super cool space for your men's basketball team and put the women over in this little cubicle. So there's things that you can help the women, you know, in equality to be – part of the university just like the men's programs are, even though they're not bringing the dollars in because they're not in that kind of media attention.
Okay.
You're saying that we're not going to have a huge campaign to boost curling.
No, I don't think so. Curling is not an emerging sport right now.
But how about lacrosse?
Lacrosse is the next big sport that's going to be because, as you can see, what lacrosse is doing. But I think they're doing that right because they're combining 1, 2, and 3 together to make it uniformed, as opposed to just having one floating out there by itself. Because if you look at the championship, and I've been part of that Division II championship because my school has won 4 national championships, and we played in these stadiums, we've come to support Division II and III in the same fashion that they've come to support Division I. And see, they're doing that right. Football has been out the bar for a long time, and that horse is running. And the lasso has been missed, and to catch it right now is going to be very, very difficult to catch that horse. So that's going to be your next emerging sport that's going to be – but the funds are being equally distributed in that sport. It's a total different environment right now.
And that's
in a way, it'll grow up in the right environment.
Well, you
exactly.
See, but that's what needs to be done in football and basketball.
But as I said, that horse is running, man. People don't want to give up that football money, man. People just don't want to share. They're in their playpen. This is my ball, and you can't have it, and I'm going home with it. My mother said, don't bounce it, don't throw it, don't kick it.
We just need to send a special prosecutor to look at this this completely criminal enterprise that's running ragged all across this country. Well, I want to thank you two guys. And listen, all right, give me your opinion. Who's winning the Super Bowl?
Seattle.
I'd like to see Seattle win. Russell Wilson seems to be doing everything right.
He's classic.
And I like his career to promote his career.
Yeah, well, Russell Wilson, Mr. What's his name? Who is the?
Richard Sherman.
Peyton.
Sherman helped out Russell Wilson in the last game, but San Francisco was driving. And all they needed was get the field goal, and they would win.
You know, that was a great game, and I hope that game is not what we consider the Super Bowl, and then we still see another great game coming. I think we will, because I think you got two equally matched teams. Peyton is going to be, you know, Peyton. So we'll see if the Seattle defense can shut down the Denver offense, and if the Seattle offense can generate some pressure on the Denver defense. So it's going to be an interesting matchup.
I personally think that the Seattle the problem is going to be Denver defense if they can stop Mr. What's his name, the quarterback for Seattle. But you see, I don't think the Seattle defense is going to be able to stop Peyton Manning.
I don't know about that. I think they're pretty tough. I think the Denver Broncos defense has this Marshawn Lynch. That's who you're going to have to stop, because that guy wears you out, man. And to get into the third or fourth quarters after he's unbounced off you and knocked you over, you see what he did the first half? He was okay. Third quarter, fourth quarter, he was killing those guys. That guy is a beast. Right. I mean, I don't call him the beast for nothing.
Right, but you saw what the quarterback for Frisco did. He marched right down the field on them.
Well, Manning's not going to do that. I mean, Peyton can't run. I mean, he's going to throw. So they don't have to worry about someone running around on him. They just got to keep him in the pocket. If they put enough pressure and push him back, just like you do with Brady, if you get a little pressure on Manning, I mean, he can't throw the ball. He's not running on you.
No,
so it's a different perspective when you're defensive, when you're looking at the defense.
Well,
that's why I think that he is the defense.
Well, defense wins Super Bowls.
Absolutely. Yeah. Defense wins games, period. I don't care what sport you're talking about.
Well, hey, you got to look at the Dallas Cowboy Denver game. I mean, Tony Romo threw over 500 yards and still lost.
Everybody's offensive. Everybody wants to shoot the ball. Everybody wants to kick it, throw it. But when you stop somebody from kicking it and throwing it and shooting it, that's where you win the game, and you're always going to be in the game.
Well, it's going to be
a great game. A couple weeks ago when they shut down the Saints by doing that.
Absolutely. The Saints couldn't know which way it was up.
He couldn't even complete the pass.
Right.
And you know how powerful Drew Brees and that offense is, with their big tight end. He didn't know which way was up.
Right.
Yeah. But that's the thing. You know, Manning has got so much experience. He's been there and done that so many times.
And
that
he's
going to have that advantage.
Right.
Just
we're hoping.
However, if they shut him down, it don't matter how much experience he's got. He can't throw the ball.
I want to thank you two guys, Big Gaff and I have you, George. We need to do a Academy Award show. So, who's your leading contender now, George? For best picture.
I don't know. Was the Butler nominated? I don't even haven't followed. Well, it's not. The Academy Award nominations haven't come out yet, have they?
Yes, they have.
The Academy Awards have? I thought it was foreign film things. I don't keep up with the awards like that.
As a matter of fact,
Captain Phillips, I'd say, is
Captain
got a good
Phillips
chance.
Is up there, yeah. That's one of the nominations.
Captain Phillips
is Captain Phillips.
Talking about 12 years and the American Hustle.
Right. Captain Phillips was not nominated, and neither was the Butler. In itself. So we'll have to see. All right, guys. I want to appreciate you guys coming on.
And by the way, Clive, thanks for the expertise inside view.
Well, I appreciate you guys having me on and the opportunity to run my mouth. So anytime you need to grab hold of me, you know where to get me.
And we'll just see. We're going to call you back as soon as the Eric Holder says he charges the racketeering.
Okay.
All right. Take it easy.
All right. You guys take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was our take on the criminal enterprise called college athletics.
Multi-billion dollar
$16 billion in the bank account. 25 years ago. Mm. You kidding me?
I wonder what the interest is on that.
Well, that's what it was 25 years ago. What, they got $100 million now?
Yeah.
They need to loan some to this country.
Yeah. And here's the thing that drives me nuts. Like I said to you before, I come from, you know, a very poor family. But my mother, back in Mississippi, teaching, and she taught for almost 50 years, but she taught for a very long time, loved teaching. However, when you have a lady like this, has her degrees, taught nonstop from college on, she was making around $19,000 with, you know, all the experience and benefits and stuff. And you look at these guys rolling in their millions. It's just kind of it's insulting to colleges. And it does make you wonder. It's like, where are our priorities? You know, we're not investing in actual education. We're investing in T-shirts and hats and mugs. They got a logo on it.
Well, you know, what we and I don't know if we're going to have time because there's so much we didn't even get to here. But I just want to play this one thing about a guy who's the former governor of Arkansas, Mike Huckabee. And let's just hear what Mike Huckabee, who started speaking about something that it was so innate, I just can't believe it. Just listen to this.
Inside Republicans no longer accept listening to the Democrats talk about a war on women. Because the fact is, the Republicans don't have a war on women. They have a war for women, for them to be empowered to be something other than victims of their gender. Women I know are outraged that the Democrats think that women are nothing more than helpless and hopeless creatures whose only goal in life is to have the government provide for them birth control medication. And if the Democrats want to insult the women of America by making them believe that they are helpless without Uncle Sugar coming in and providing for them a prescription each month for birth control because they cannot control their libido or their reproductive system without the help of the government, then so be it. Let us take that discussion all across America, because women are far more than the Democrats have played them to be. And women across America need to stand up and say, enough of that nonsense.
Now,
Uncle Sugar.
Now, just listen to this here. Now, I want to know the difference between what Huckabee said and the Republican leader said.
What does it say about the college co-ed Susan Fluke, who goes before a congressional committee and essentially says that she must be paid to have sex? What does that make her? It makes her a slut, right? Makes her a prostitute.
So what was the difference, Thomas, between what Rush Limbaugh said and Mike Huckabee?
Well, a double thing on Mike. You know, Mike, back when he was a governor, signed into law a bill that provided all of that for women.
That's right.
He was just complaining about Mr. Hypocrite. Now, on top of that, you've got to understand this in context. What Mike is doing is what we just saw roll out across the board this week, because they just introduced a huge new class of women Republicans, as you saw that, and they just have the rebuttal to the president's speech this year is going to be female. And the reason for that is because they're in desperate trouble with women voters, and they know it. And so they've got a huge pushback going, so they're trying to reclaim that. And so I think that's what Mike's doing. I think Mike was going to be their opening salvo, but it didn't come off right. But they're desperately trying to say, no, we're the party of women. We're standing for women's rights. And those dastardly, you know, Democrats are against it. But that's because they've been losing on every side. So, all these repressive Taliban-esque policies they keep promoting.
Well, why would they, how do they get across a claiming that the Democrats are running a war on women?
Because it's the same thing. Look, like I just said, and you got to think, Mike Huckabee is an evangelical. They It's just the exact same thing. You remember the Taliban, you know, the whole thing with the putting everybody in the burqa and all that kind of stuff was to protect women's dignity and rights and everything else because of the you know, evil. If you see them, you might be driven mad into, you know, salacious thoughts and lustful acts. And so it's, you know, in their mind, when you limit things and restrict things and deny women, you know, equal rights and all these types of things and, you know, birth control or anything else, you've somehow empowered them because that's making them more, you know, godlike and virtuous or whatever their theory is. So that's why it's like a twisted logic that if you allow them to act on their own and choose on their own, suddenly they're going to become depraved animals and that's going to lower them. You know, like the fall from Eden, you know.
Before, when my friends on the left side of the aisle here try to make rape and incest the subject, because you know the incidence of rape and resulting in pregnancy are very low, but
well, you know,
it's very low, you know.
Yes, look, we in the same week we just had. Republican lawmakers. One said that America was being hit with tornadoes and, you know, floods and all other natural disasters because God was angry that we supported gays and gay rights and allowed gays.
Yeah, that was that moron down there.
Yeah. So again, are these people who they think that it's wrong to have any kind of rights or freedoms. So it's kind of interesting.
Well,
their take.
Well, their take.
So in their way, I mean, they're saying that by giving women their own autonomy, you're hurting them.
Well,
you know, you got to remember, these are the guys who also say that they believe that the Bible says that the woman is subject to the man and must, you know, kowtow and bow before him all day long.
Well, I don't, this is what I don't understand. Why would it sound like something that? Rich Priebus, didn't he say at the end of the last election we have to self-exam where the party is going and we can't
together and they said that, you know, that was the outcome was that they have to completely change course and quit being idiots. You know, that was that whole panel that they went through, the whole self-examination, and they came out with all those points they were going to correct.
Right.
But they don't seem to be correcting. But, yeah, one of them, they said minorities, they said, you know, everything else, but one of them was with women. They had to correct course on women voters. So this is their attempt, but it's it's failing out of the gate. So I don't know what.
Well, then what do we want to take away from what Huckabee said in the next election? Because he is setting himself up to be a nominee again, to run.
Well, I mean, he's not, you know, I think these people are always obsessed with themselves and getting out there and getting their name known. But, I mean, hey, we've had this week Mitt Romney is complaining that Putin is a better leader than Obama. You know, I mean, they're always trying to, desperate to get some spotlight. So I think maybe Huckabee is just trying to get that spotlight yet again. I don't know why.
Yet we're trying
This is the thing. You've got, just like you played that dichotomy, you've got, you know, Rush on the one hand saying that, you know, anybody who dares be independent is nothing more than a slut, you know. These are the same people, you remember, the same charges they had against Hillary. That's why they hated Hillary, because she was an assertive. She didn't stand meekly in the background as wallpaper to the president. She was trying to be a partner to the president. You remember how they said, oh, she's like a unelected official. She was like a unappointed cabinet member. You know, she tried to even do health care. You remember that was an accusation against her. And that whole thing, she should stay home and bake cookies or whatever. You remember
there?
I mean, how insulting. How completely
I'm not Tammy Wynette.
Yeah. So you've got that on one side, that, you know your place, woman. Sit down and shut up. And then on the other side, oh, it's the Democrats that are hurting women and keeping them down.
Well,
what are you saying?
Well, we didn't have time to talk completely about Mr. Governor Christie. But you know what it seems
that's a good force.
Because they're talking about how much he was the enforcer and how he didn't get his hands dirty.
Mm-hmm.
And how everything he said was sort of
he just runs the garbage company.
Well,
I just want to, like the mayor of Hoboken and the mayor of Fort Lee, when I heard what they said, it sort of reminded me of this scenario with Michael Corleone met with Senator Pat Geary about the casinos. I'm going to play that for you.
You own or you control two major hotels in Vegas, one in Reno. The licenses were grandfathered in, so there was no problem with the gaming commission. Now, my sources tell me that you plan to make a move against the Tropicana. They tell me that within a week, you're going to move Clingman out. That's quite an expansion. However, it will leave you with one little technical problem. The license will still be in Clingman's name. Turnbull is a good man. Yeah, well, let's cut out the bullshit. I don't want to spend any more time here than I have to. You can have the license. Price is $250,000, plus a monthly payment of 5% of the gross. Of all four hotels, Mr. Corleone. Now, the price for the license is less than $20,000, am I right? That's right. Now, why would I ever consider paying more than that? Because I intend to squeeze you. I don't like you kind of people. I don't want to see you come out to this clean country in your oily hair, dressed up in those silk suits, and try to pass yourselves off as decent Americans. I'll do business with you, but the fact is that I despise your masquerade, the dishonest way you pose yourself. Yourself and your whole fucking family. Senator, we're both part of the same hypocrisy. But never think it applies to my family. All right, all right. Some people have to play little games. You play yours. So let's just say that you'll pay me because it's in your interest to pay me. But I want you answering the money by noon tomorrow. And one more thing. Don't you contact me again, ever. From now on, you deal with Turnbull. Put in the book, sir. And Senator, you can have my answer now if you like. My offer is this. Nothing. Not even a fee for the gaming license, which I would appreciate if you would put up personally.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Nothing. And I appreciate if you put up the money for the gaming license personally.
Yeah, that I have to have. You know, that,
yeah.
It's like my fee.
Well, the problem that really made him mad is when he said he included his family in it. Mm-hmm. Now, this sounds like something, a scenario that Mr. Christie would make.
No. Well, yeah. Like I think, I think my easiest way to understand Christie is just that he's one of those old school, you know, boss kind of politicians. Not a real politician today, but in the old school way. That's the way that everything was. It was run like mobs. Like little fiefdoms, and you had your patronage you paid. Now, that's why, if you look at it, like they had that interesting little thing on the Port Authority the other day when they were talking about how, you know, it was set up to be a bi-state fair and equal division of trade and everything going through there. And it only recently, in the last 10 years, under Republicans, has become a partisan thing where they appoint personal appointees, little cronies,
yeah.
Jobs.
Well, yes, the lieutenant, the governor of Jersey is one of the most powerful governor's positions in the entire country and all the states.
Yeah,
because
Texas.
They appoint everybody.
Yeah, but he's appointing, you know, just personal friends and all that.
Of course.
It's like little Putin over there. You know,
well, here's, now, we're talking about bullying. Here's some examples here.
And you know what? And you know what? And you know what? Let me tell you this. You know what?
It's people who raise their voices and yell and scream like you that are dividing this country.
Hey, Gail, you know what? First off, it's none of your business. I'll ask you where you're sending your kids to school. Don't bother me about where I send mine.
Hey, did I say on topic? Are you stupid? On topic. On topic. Thank you all very much, and I'm sorry for the idiot over there.
And let me tell you something. After you graduate from law school, you conduct yourself like that in the courtroom, your rear end's going to get thrown in jail, idiot.
Oh, so is this pot calling the kettle black here? He don't yell at anybody?
Well, yeah.
So how does he try to convince people that that of something like this?
I'm embarrassed and humiliated by the conduct of some of the people on my team. I had no knowledge or involvement in this issue, in its planning or its execution, and I am stunned by the abject stupidity that was shown here. I was blindsided yesterday morning. We have nothing to hide, and this administration has nothing to hide.
And
embarrassed and humiliated.
He's embarrassed and humiliated. Now, how do you know what else he is not telling us? Because he did tell one little school child this.
My question is, what is your favorite thing to do as governor?
Here's my favorite thing about being governor on the fun side. Going to New York City when you're governor. They closed the Lincoln Tunnel for you. You get to drive right through. No traffic. It's the best. I love going to New York now. I used to hate it because I sit in the traffic. Now, no traffic. I love it.
That reminds me of a very famous line out of history from, you may have heard this person, fantastic historian, Mel Brooks. It's good to be the king.
Yes. It's good to be the king. Yes,
no.
Absolutely.
Now, where
right.
is this boy? Yes. That's one of the perks of kingship is the power. You get to go to New York. But you know what's telling about that? They cracked me up. What's your favorite thing is New Jersey governor, sir?
Going
to
New York. Right.
What an ad for New York. Right?
Unbelievable. And we're going to have to, there was a whole lot of things I wanted to play. I wanted to play with what the lieutenant governor said.
Yeah,
but we don't have time now. You got 20 seconds.
Never mind. Forget it.
Okay.
We'll talk about it next time.
All right. We will talk about it next time. And this has been The Last Word with Michael Lawson and Thomas Fortenberry. And as Christie likes to say,
when the news is all bad, when you're sour and blue, when you start to get mad, you should do what I do. Tell yourself how lucky you are. When the fates are unkind, when your life's going wrong, when you're limping along and get kicked from behind, tell yourself how lucky you are. Why decry a cloudy sky? An empty purse, a crazy universe. My philosophy is simply things could be worse. So be happy you're here. Think of life as a thrill. And if worse comes to worse, as we all know it will, thank your lucky star, you've gotten this far. And tell yourself how lucky you are. How lucky, how lucky, how lucky, how lucky, how lucky, how lucky you are. When the news is all bad. When you're sour and blue, when you start to get mad, you should do what I do. Tell yourself how lucky you are. When the fates are unkind, when your life's going wrong, when you're limping along and get kicked from behind, tell yourself how lucky you are. Why decry a cloudy sky, an empty purse, a crazy universe? My philosophy is simply things could be worse. So be happy you're here. Think of life as a thrill. And if worse comes to worse, as we all know it will, thank your lucky star you've gotten this far. And tell yourself how lucky you are. How lucky, how lucky, how lucky, how lucky, how lucky, how lucky, how lucky you are.